On behalf of the Associated Students of Rocky Mountain College, I would like to welcome all of you to our second in the series of our lectures. At this time, I would like to introduce James Taylor, who is the registrar of our college. Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Gina. You may hold your applause for the man who is to speak to you tonight, a man whom it has been my pleasure to know for a number of years when I was in the Boston area going to school, a man who spoke to a large crowd here last year, I think there were 25. I was ashamed to introduce him at that time, but I'm very happy to be able to introduce him at this time to this large crowd which has gathered to hear him. Perhaps not as large as the 8,500 students who recently heard him a week or so ago at Southern Illinois University, or the large crowd to whom he spoke at Harvard University only Monday evening of this week, or the crowd that I still, it galls me to know that in a little town of Hamilton, Montana, this man spoke to over 2,000 people 2 years ago, and that at Billings we can't fill a hall which will hold just under 300. However, that is beside the point. The man who comes to us today is not in Who's Who, as some of you found out from the radio this morning. Does not have a master's degree in anything. He went from Boston Public Schools into the service in the Second World War, served with distinction, and then began the course which his life has taken from that time, the study of extreme movements in America, something which is not new to American politics, American thought, but something which is ever present with us. So it does give me a great deal of pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Gordon Hall, who is an expert on the subject. Mr. Hall.
Thank you. I wish I could have been here to catch some of the telephone calls that I've been told about on several occasions today. You know, I'm really not in Who's Who. It never occurred to me to even attempt to be, although I've had numerous letters asking me if I would like to be. It just never occurred to me that it was of any special importance one way or the other. I've had a lot of things used against me in the course of going around the country talking about the lunatic fringe, but I've never had that particular one used before. I also understand that someone from Billings called the Boston Chamber of Commerce or something to attempt to get some information about me, and why anybody here would even think to call the Boston Chamber of Commerce is really beyond me, and I frankly do not believe that any such call was made. All I hope it was, because it was expensive, and if there's anything that I like more than having people run up big telephone bills when they come from that camp, it's running up big postage bills or something, but if anybody had written to the Chamber of Commerce or called, it just so happens that I do a good deal of writing for the Boston Chamber of Commerce and a good deal of lecturing for them. So I can't imagine any report that might have reached here that would not have been extremely favorable. And then I understand someone called the Boston Public Library, which would be rather a curious place to call also. And since I very frequently lecture at the Boston Public Library to old age groups and all kinds of organizations that meet there, and since the director is a good friend of mine, I can't imagine how that report would have been anything but favorable. So if the persons are here who made the calls, I can give you a long list of other places that you might call as well, in Boston and Des Moines and elsewhere, and I'll be happy to share them with you. And if that person or persons is here, I just happen to have with me the reprint that the Boston Chamber put out a short time ago of something I did for them called Extremism, Sickness of the 60s. It's an 8-page reprint which bears the Boston Chamber's label, and if anybody would like it, I have some extra copies. So, we dispense with the usual foolishness that somehow or other seems to come in the wake of my speaking anywhere. Also, I am not Gus Hall of the Communist Party. We are no relationship at all. Gus Hall, whose name isn't Hall at all, mine is the secretary of the Communist Party USA. He is of Finnish extraction, and his name is Hallberg, really, H-A-L-V-B-E-R-G. But he changed it because apparently that's a difficult name to pronounce and spell, and Paul seemed easier. I'm of Scotch-English extraction, and my name really is Gordon Paul, and there's no connection. But this intentional error keeps coming up all the time. My friends in the John Birch Society in particular know perfectly well that I am not Gus Hall. But they like to gloss over such things for the benefit of making it appear that perhaps I am. And if you ask Gus Hall about me, he will tell you that I am the leading John Bircher. That's what he thinks about me, you see, the confusion is rampant in America. Well, I'm going to do pretty much what I did last year, since, as Mr. Tedder pointed out, we have some people tonight and we didn't last year. And I am not nearly as bothered by the size of audiences as apparently Mr. Taylor is, although naturally anybody who comes all this distance wants as many people as possible to talk to. There is really no way of ever knowing, quite seriously, how many people will turn out. I did speak in Hamilton, and we had, as far as I know, something in the neighborhood of 3,100 people. And since there aren't that many people in the Bitterroot Valley, I was as surprised as everybody else. Now, I don't know why they came out or what it was, but they even had to postpone the elk stands over there so that I could speak in the place where the elks have their dances. And that's the first time that's ever happened to me. In fact, I was getting a haircut in Hamilton, and I saw a sign. The elk stands will be held after the lecture, which is just one of my great trophies. I don't have very many trophies, but this was the big poster in the town that I simply had to take down from one of the barbershop windows and take it home with me. And then in Carbondale, Illinois, last week, or 10 days ago, to a voluntary convocation of students, there were some 8,700. Now, I don't know why one would reach that many. I spoke in West Liberty, West Virginia, and had 15,000 people out. And there aren't 15,000 people in West Liberty. And then sometimes I can speak in my own backyard of Boston and draw 25. So there's no way of knowing ever. And I am interested in reaching anyone who comes out and is willing to sit and listen to me. Now, the problem, as I see it, on extremists is pretty much the same as it was when I was here, and I've forgotten when I was here.
When was I here?
This year or
this last winter?
But this year,
I
think it was in 1965. The problem is pretty much the same as it was then, although some of the surface manifestations are different. For example, you're looking at a Viet Cong flag, which is being sold by some Americans in an effort to raise money for the Viet Cong, or the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, which is an arm of the North Vietnamese government and is also part of the Viet Cong, although sometimes these labels get confused in some of the reporting out of that troubled spot. Now, that is a new wrinkle. Last February or last winter, whenever it was that I was here, there were no such flags being sold on college campuses or anywhere else. So that is new, but the overall problem of extremists versus the middle remains fairly constant. And so, with your indulgence, I'm going to go through some of the same territory that I went through last time, simply because I think it's important to constantly emphasize that audiences in general do not fully comprehend as yet, in my judgment, the differences between the politics of moderation and the politics of immoderation. And one of the reasons why, for example, there has been some growth of the John Birch Society, although not the growth that they are boasting about, is because many people cannot distinguish between them and the conservatives in American life. The reason that there has been some growth on college campuses of the extreme left, although not as great as the extreme left would have us believe, is because many students do not know the difference between liberals and communists. And when they join some of these student Marxist movements, they believe that they are serving a kind of liberal approach in American politics. And there has been a growth of the Ku Klux Klan as a response to the civil rights drive, although this has not been as great as Ku Klux Klaners would have us believe. But by the same token, the people joining the Ku Klux Klan in many cases And some of you may have seen the CBS television documentary on the Invisible Empire. Many people who join the Klan somehow believe they are serving the best interest of Christianity by so doing. And so there is this still, this muddy area of people going into things, sometimes for the best of motives, in one way of looking at it, and yet, in reality, they are joining movements that have abolished parliamentary procedures, the democratic process, and really and truly belong on the extremes of one side or the other. So I do want to talk about the broad middle first, especially for the benefit of those who did not hear me last time, and that, I think, is probably most of you. And then we'll talk also about the extremes, and I will leave time for questions for as long as the interest remains, since I don't have to get a plane to Denver until something like 9:35 tomorrow morning, and there isn't much doing in town, so I will stay here with you. Today, on a couple of radio and TV newscasts, I got in some of the local stations, and I was asked the question to begin with, what is an extremist? Now, this is a good question, and normally is not asked of me. For some reason, many of the newsmen and radio and TV around the country make assumptions that when we talk about extremists, everyone knows exactly what we are talking about. Well, I want to begin first by at least touching on at least a partial definition of extremism, because I think it is important to perhaps begin there and then talk in terms about that which is not extreme. In no sense, and despite what my critics will say both here and elsewhere, in no sense am I guilty of charging that someone is extreme because of a single rash statement on American politics or something else, or a single rash act, or even seven or eight rash acts. When I talk about extremists, I am talking about organizations, publications, leaders, rank and file, and so on, that are guilty of this kind of thing as a way of life. That there is really little else in their lives but adherence to a fixed dogma of one group or another, a fixed body of principles. And I'm talking about the kinds of groups, publications, and individuals that use as daily weapons in their daily combat with our government the business of character assassination, loss of faith in democratic institutions, the big lie, the substitution of extremist measures for democratic ones. There are many problems facing the United States, and there are many problems in communities like Billings and other communities all over the country of comparable size. And most of these problems in our free system can be met through democratic means. There are democratic solutions for problems because we are a free system. When I speak of extremists, I'm talking about the kinds of people who have so lost faith in our system that they recommend extremist solutions for that which can be solved democratically. So I don't want anybody leaving tonight and saying that what I really said, in effect, was that anybody disagreeing with me is somehow an extremist. That's not the case at all. It takes a long time before I decide that I will include a group or a publication or a leader in my public discussions of this problem. And it only comes after many, many months and sometimes years of day in and day out activity of this type, so that by any kind of objective definition, this is indeed extremism. Now, I'm not even quarreling with their right to be extreme. I'm merely explaining them away as being extremist in a free society where, again, there usually are democratic solutions. Now, first we'll turn to the broad middle, and I want to emphasize that we're talking tonight about political movements and political extremes in the United States, and we are talking about the total American scene, the total political spectrum, and not any other kind of scene, not Great Britain, France, West Germany, Italy, or any of the Asian or African countries, or even the Latin American countries. A lot of people seem to think that when you talk about extremes in a broad sense, that somehow you can include every nation on earth, and you cannot, because that which is left and right and center in American terms may be quite the opposite in European terms in some instances, and certainly very different in Asian and African terms. So we're talking about American politics, and we're talking about extremism in the political sense, not in any other sense. There are plenty of extremists in loads and loads of areas, and I can think of some popular singers that I would regard as being extremely bad or something else, and we won't get into that, but we're talking about American politics. And I'm very happy, by the way, watching the Sinatra thing the other night. I don't know how many of you saw the background portrait of Frank Sinatra. He said that he hopes that somebody, somewhere along the line, learns to adopt the style that he has perfected, the bel canto style of singing, the smooth, unflowing, broken, unbroken melody kind of thing, where words still had meaning. And he said that as far as he's concerned, the current crop of singers may well be all right, except that it's so difficult to understand what they're singing about. And I don't see how anything could be more to the point than that. But we're not talking about things that tend to be extreme or out of line or way out of something else in other areas, simply about politics. Although I would insist that a nation of young people growing up and being wholly indifferent to words of song, so that they have no meaning, and it really doesn't matter anyway, which is the argument I always get, it would seem to me that people of that type, year in and year out, being subjected to words again that are really without any particular meaning, could easily become the prey of demagogues in the political sense. And there's a correlation here somewhere. I haven't even worked it out in my own mind, as you can readily see, but I think that it is extremely important to keep in mind that there are many things that are interrelated and interconnected to my subject, but we are going to skip to the area of politics this evening. Also keep in mind that the definitions that I use will apply to the current scene and not the past. Many people are fond of telling me, well, conservatives may be what you say they are now, but they weren't that way 2 centuries ago, or a century and a half ago, or even 9 or 10 decades ago, and I'm well aware of this. I'm well aware of the fact, for example, that when Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, America faced an internal crisis, the likes of which it hasn't faced since in terms of the economy itself, and thus certain measures were, emergency measures were rushed through the House and the Senate and signed into law by the late president. And this would not happen today because we have a different kind of an economy in the sense that it's far more stable. And we aren't facing a Great Depression with long red lines and all the rest. And thus, what may have been fairly radical in 1932 is kind of accepted today by both parties and liberals and conservatives alike. I'm well aware of that. So we are talking about right now, up to the moment, and we're talking about the American scene. Now, the dominant force in American politics, whether one likes it or not, and this has nothing to do with my preference or your preference, it's a matter of history, the dominant force in American politics is the liberal tradition. We are essentially a liberal country, and our greatest tradition is the liberal one, and it's kind of an ongoing tradition. It's not new. It didn't happen yesterday, but it's very much with us, and liberals are the dominant part of what I call the mainstream. Now, the mainstream is the mainstream simply because there are more people, in political terms, subscribing to the programs and policies of major parties than any minor parties. Thus, it becomes a mainstream simply by the sheer weight of numbers, the sheer force of numbers. There are more people certainly willing to support a Johnson and a Goldwater in a national election than a wide variety of third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh party candidates, of which there were in that particular race. You have constitution parties, prohibition parties, vegetarian parties, socialist workers parties, socialist labor parties, all kinds of parties. And yet the bulk of the American people can be found in the kind of mainstream context voting for either a Johnson or a Goldwater, or late President Kennedy and a Nixon, or an Eisenhower and a Stevenson, and so on all the way back in terms of the 20th century. So that's what I mean by a mainstream. Obviously, there are more people there than anywhere else, although no one even knows for certain how many are in the mainstream, except that it is fair to say that there are more people there than anywhere else. Now, the liberal tradition is the dominant part of that mainstream because liberal candidates triumph over and over and over again in national elections, and very often in state and municipal elections. And they are the dominant force, and their ideas dominate American political life. And their basic ideas have been and continue to be the ideas of political reform. The liberals are the innovators, the experimenters, and the reformers in American political life, and because this is the case, they have reached out and obviously touched the hearts and minds of more people than any other single tradition in American political life. And thus they rule the roost in terms of the mainstream. Now, by reform, by political reform, I simply mean the orderly and systematic modification of our system as opposed to a disorderly and a revolutionary change in our system. Liberals believe that we have to modify our system because there are constant changes all the time, ranging anywhere from classroom shortages to lack of scholarship money to deserving students to the race problem to cluttered highways, to blight, to smog, to all kinds of domestic and international problems, and the way to beat them is to constantly have reform so that we keep up to date and we modify our system through the legislative process to meet these challenges. Now, like it or not, that is at the heart of what liberals are all about, and that's what they do, and this is the thing that has brought them the greatest triumphs on the American political scene. Now, liberals are not the kinds of people who believe in this, as some people seem to think, because it's a good vote-getting device. Liberals are much better than that, as are the conservatives. People just don't sit down in back rooms and say, well, now look, we'll spend all the money we can spend, tax the people as heavily as we can, and we'll dream up all sorts of schemes to keep ourselves in office. There may occasionally be men in public life like that, but by and large, that's not the way our system works. Liberals, too, have principles, although you may or may not agree with them. And one of the things that I can never quite fathom is the kind of person in American life, be he liberal or a conservative or the extreme left or the extreme right, assumes because he doesn't believe what the other fellow believes that therefore the other fellow's motives are not very pure. You see, like when I travel around, I take it for granted that the Birches love America. I don't quarrel with their patriotism. I quarrel with the substance of their patriotism. I think it's misguided, and it's ignorant, and it's misinformed, and it's malicious. But I don't quarrel with the fact that most of them are motivated by patriotism. But to all of them, to all of the Birches, I'm a communist and a traitor. You see, my motives could not be pure. I couldn't be motivated to do what I do because I happen to feel strongly about it. I have to be sinister. I have to be a traitor or something along the lines. And there are many people, it seems to me, who seem to think that because liberals are dominant, that that's because they sit around and work up programs that will bring them more and more votes, and they sit in the back rooms and rub their hands in glee. Well, it's not really like that at all. Most of the liberals in American political life are the kinds of people who believe in reform because they believe that man is essentially good. They believe that somehow man is much better than he is worse. He's much more positive than negative. And all we need do, argues the American liberal, is to provide opportunity, the widest possible kind of opportunity for all of our citizens, and then our citizens will show the stuff that they are made of. They will put their best foot forward. All this being true in the mind of the liberal, reform becomes the political translation of this basic philosophical position that they have adopted. Now, they may be right or they may be wrong. This may be wise or it may be unwise. It may be just or it may be unjust. But the point is that this is what they believe in, and the people like Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois, and the people like Vice President Humphrey, and many, many other people in American political life that we normally identify with a liberal tradition. John Lindsay of New York City, a Republican liberal. Jacob Javits, a New York senator who is also a Republican liberal, and so on. These are the kind of men and women in American political life who believe deeply that the best interest of this nation can be served through reform, and reform is the whole key to the future because it brings about an orderly change in our society, a modification. Very often it's slight. It's not a very vast change, but it's enough change to keep the wheels going and keep our system moving and coping with the problems that face all of us. So then, their basic position is belief in the goodness of man, and this becomes translated politically by the business of seeking reform and as wide a reform as possible. Now, the conservatives run a second best in American political life simply because they have fewer votes. fewer people believing in their programs. The appeal of the conservatives is very limited. It's very narrow. This doesn't mean that it's a bad or a good appeal. It simply means that these are the facts of life. Conservatives have fewer people voting for them, and thus Mr. Goldwater, far more conservative than Mr. Johnson in the last race, wound up a rather overwhelmingly defeated candidate, as I'm sure you recognize in a moment. You have to go back much further than that. Or you could take the recent election in New York, where Mr. Lindsay, a liberal, triumphed over Mr. William F. Buckley, Jr., kind of a conservative, if you will, and although not conservative in my judgment in the sense that Goldwater is, but still a conservative, and he garnered only the tiniest fraction of the total vote in the New York City area. So over and over again, we see liberals defeating conservatives. Thus, we must conclude, if we have eyes in our head and can read, that conservatives have a much more narrow appeal. Now, their basic position is as follows. They reject, to begin with, this liberal insistence on the basic and essential goodness of all mankind. And conservatives say that this isn't the case at all, and that liberals are mistaken to emphasize this, that the basic condition of all mankind is contradiction, that everybody in this auditorium this evening, and including the three individuals on the stage, are a bundle of contradictions, that we have many things going for us, one at the same time. We have generous impulses and impulses that are not so generous. We have just and unjust impulses. We are filled with hate as well as love. We have envy as well as pride. There are many, many things that go on in all of our minds, sometimes simultaneously, and that we are ambivalent, ambiguous, and contradictory, because this is normal, this is human. And this being the case, argues the American conservative, the first thing to do is to limit the powers of politicians over the lives of the rest of us and to hack away at the vastness of federal government in Washington, D.C. The central theme of the American conservative is the limitations of the powers of the federal government, the state governments and municipal governments, but the main thrust is at the bigness and the scope and the vastness of a federal bureaucracy. And that is really what conservatives are talking about all of the time in political terms. They are worried about the powers of federal government. Now, they say that all history supports their thesis. And look at the 20th century, where you had the rise of the great police states, the great totalitarian dictatorships, communism, fascism, Nazism, even some military political dictatorships have arisen in this century in particular. Now, the conservative argues that this is because most of the people living in these countries were indifferent and apathetic. And a few men gained power over the lives of others by consolidating their power, entrenching their power, and then refusing to give it up, as in Nazi Germany, as in the Soviet Union, as in both Batista's Cuba and Castro's Cuba, and so on. And all this being true, argues the conservative, we must look to this as an evil. This must be opposed, and reform is a secondary consideration, although many conservatives have, on occasion, supported reform measures because the reform measures were so pressing that they had saw the wisdom of it and had to go along with it. But by and large, conservatives are in a different area entirely. Now, these are deeply held views on both sides, and it's a mistake to suggest that the conservatives are mossbacks and short-sighted and stupid or something else, just as it is to impugn the motives of the liberals. These are beliefs that men and women in American political life come to after a long struggle with their consciences. Most of the conservatives that I know deeply believe these things, and it really doesn't matter whether I agree with them or not. And everything that they do flows very, very systematically from these views. If you take the most important domestic question facing us and look at the way the sides lined up, you will see that this thesis has great validity in terms of what really does happen. This is really the way the system works out. The liberals believe, for example, that Negroes have been denied their fundamental constitutional guarantees. And that's an argument that it would seem to me that most of us, if we were going to look at this fairly and squarely, would also have to agree is true. Negroes have indeed been denied equal opportunities. And thus the liberals sought reform in this area. Now, they didn't say, we are going to have a civil rights bill, which is a reform bill. No, but the Civil Rights Bill was a reform bill aimed at correcting what they felt were the injustices, the indignities, and the discrimination against our fellow citizens of a different skin coloration. And so they did manage to put together an omnibus Civil Rights Bill, fought it through the House and the Senate, and it eventually became law under the Johnson administration, the major civil rights bill, and the first really major all-encompassing civil rights bill in American political history. Now, they believe that Negroes are part of mankind, liberals argued. When I say they, in this instance, I mean liberals. They argue that since liberals are part of mankind, when they have opportunities to compete with the rest of us and go to some decent schools and get some decent jobs and live in some decent neighborhoods and so on, and not endlessly be the last in line, the last hired in the first fight and so on, then they will show that they are just like the rest of us, and they'll take their place side by side on the American scene, because they are a part of mankind and they are overwhelmingly good, as all individuals are in the minds of the liberals in the United States. Now, the conservatives said, no, this bill is dangerous. Not because it might bring about some kind of first-class citizenship. That's not the point at all, argued the conservatives. The point is that if we allow the federal government federal regulatory powers here, then next week or next year or in the next session of Congress, they'll want more federal regulatory powers, and pretty soon we're going to wind up with powers that will control our lives from the time we get up in the morning till the time we go to bed at night. Thus, this bill must be opposed on the grounds that it establishes further dangerous precedents and increases the scope of the federal government in areas that are best left alone for voluntary consideration. And the conservative argued that we ought to learn to love and mutually respect one another based on the individual merit theme, that you accept a person regardless of his race, color, or creed on the basis of individual merit, and you accept or reject them along these lines rather than because the federal government says you can't do this or you can't do that. Now, that comes back right squarely on this overall thesis of mine, namely that liberals act out of the compulsion that reform is needed because mankind is overwhelmingly good, and the conservatives trying to limit the powers of the federal government because they believe that man is contradictory. And how do we know that the people that we send to Washington or elsewhere are going to govern us wisely? The best that we can hope for is that they will govern us wisely, but you can never be sure because man is a contradiction, etc., etc., etc. Now, you can take any issue that you want in American political life, and the arguments that are set forth, the great debates in the broad middle, are always along these lines, although they are not stated in just these terms. A conservative doesn't stand up and preface everything that he argues about by saying, I believe man is a contradiction. And a liberal doesn't stand up and say, I believe man is good. But somewhere, inherent and implicit in the whole approach on both sides, as you read and wade through the speeches and the arguments and the position papers and so on, which you must do if you want to understand American political life, you will come up, obviously, with this kind of position taken by both of these mainstream traditions. Now, that's what the broad middle is all about. That is what I call the politics of compromise, the politics of alternatives, the politics of moderation, the politics where parliamentary procedures and the democratic process is in full flavor. And I honor the middle of the road, and in a very unabashed way, if that's the word, unabashedly, I honor the middle of the road for the very good reason that this is the area where there are alternatives. And it's the only area in our national political life where there are alternatives. The edges are closed completely. They are prisoners of a certain kind of a dogma, whether it's the monthly members bulletin of the John Birch Society out of Belmont, Massachusetts, which freely translated tells you whom you're supposed to hate in a given month, or whether it's the dogma of the extreme left with their emphasis on Marxist-Leninism or something else. I'm going to take up both of these sides very shortly. But whatever else may be the faults of the broad center, there are alternatives. And if you don't like the liberals running the government, then you can get to work and get all your friends to work to get rid of them. And sometimes you can. Sometimes you can, depending on how persuasive or how lacking you may be in persuasion. Or if you like a conservative candidate, you can work for him. It just takes a little time for the years to roll by and you move new men into office and move the old men out or seek to place candidates that happen to regard to your views. And at least there's that alternative, if nothing else. In fact, I would agree with Winston Churchill's definition of the broad center. He has said that the broad center in American life, being part of the whole democratic parliamentary heritage, has become, in modern contemporary terms, a Tower of Babel, and it is indeed. And he says that obviously the democracies are the worst systems anywhere in the world, and the United States is indeed the worst system anywhere in the world, except for all of the others. And I certainly would be inclined to agree that this is as neat a definition as you'll find on the subject of a free and open society. Now the extremes. There's a good deal of confusion about who and what is on the extreme, because extremists have almost no sense of responsibility. It isn't that they don't need to have responsibility. Some of them think that they're the most responsible people in the world. But they are so utterly irresponsible. I can cite an instance when I spoke at the University of Montana in Missoula, also earlier this year. And there were all kinds of sheets going around campus about me, put out by Birch members in that area and other groups, calling me every kind of name under the sun, scandalous, libelous statements made about me. So much so, of course, that some of the people in the area were upset and decided that they would take some action and maybe wire the government or something else. You know, the need to go and find out, is he really what he says he is? Well, at any rate, one of the sheets condemned me and claimed that the House Committee on Un-American Activities had very often condemned me as a communist and so on. And so one of the newspapers there, one of the editors, wired ahead to the House Committee and asked the chairman of the House Committee on American Activities if all of this is true, and got a telegram back saying, no, quite the opposite. We regard him as a very sensible anti-communist who knows a good deal about the communists and is very effective in fighting them. And we have nothing in our files of a derogatory nature on the man who's going to address the students. In fact, we think very highly of him. And when the House Committee on American Activities says this, it's like Florence Nightingale endorsing him. And yet the same extremist in the Missoula area persisted in putting out the same leaflets. And when I went into the auditorium to speak to a fairly large student and adult grouping, there were sheets all over the place, even after this, even after that particular newspaper ran a front page editorial denouncing the smears and all the rest. So when I'm telling you that extremists are almost hopelessly lacking in a sense of responsibility, I am speaking the truth. Even when they are shown that night isn't day and that day isn't night, they persist in believing that these things are so. And there's very little that one can do about it other than to hope that by explaining away the extremist and talking about the broad middle, perhaps some small dent at least can be made and all is not lost. For example, to the extreme left in the United States, anybody not in agreement with them automatically becomes someone on the extreme right, or becomes a fascist, a Nazi, or a Bircher, a Hitler-like person or something of the sort. And to those on the extreme right, anybody not in agreement with them almost automatically becomes someone on the extreme left. And that is why, in the course of 1 month, I can be denounced savagely in the John Birch Society bulletins as a fellow traveler, a traitor, a communist, or worse. And in the same issue of a communist publication, I can be described as a fascist, and as a Nazi, and as an Uncle Tom, and every other name under the sun, or a stool pigeon for the FBI and the House Committee. And it doesn't make any difference whether the charges have any relevance to truth. It's just that it's a very handy kind of thing to seize upon when emotionally upset about something that I may, or for the part, not have said, because they don't even get straight what I have said. Or, on the extremes, you can find, for example, that in the last count, it was described by the extreme left, and by the way, here are two books of sample materials of the extreme left, and two of the extreme right, and that little strip down the middle is not the middle of the road. The middle of the road is much larger than both. But I'm not going to put up Reader's Digest on the board for you to look at. I certainly know that that's not an extremist magazine or Look, Life, and Time, and so on. Although to the extreme, middle of the road publications are extreme, if you follow that kind of reasoning. But anyway, in the last election, Mr. Goldwater was endlessly described as an American Hitler who would build concentration camps if he were elected to the presidency, that he would bring about a catastrophic third war, that he was a Nazi and a fascist and a junk and a good many other things. That was the version of the extreme left. And on the extreme right, we had the usual version of describing former President Eisenhower as a communist, a fellow traveler, and a dedicated conscientization of the Soviet conspiracy. Now, it seems to me that when you are concerned about the truth, somewhere in the broad middle, where one can get at the truth much more readily, that one would speak out as quickly against the attacks of the extreme left on Mr. Goldwater, which I did repeatedly in the last election campaign, although I personally favored President Johnson. I thought that the smears against Mr. Goldwater were outrageous and were very much, by the way, like the kind of smears that we heard so much about in relationship to President Eisenhower and the John Birch Society. Now, this is know-nothingism on either side, and it seems to me that if we're going to make any sense out of the world we live in and the American political scene, it behooves all of us, if we are anywhere in the politics of moderation or the politics of alternatives, that we would do well to keep in mind that the same type of mindless mentality that calls Mr. Eisenhower a communist is the kind of a person ultimately who calls someone like Senator Goldwater a fascist or a Nazi. Neither charge is true, and they should both be condemned, in my judgment, if we're going to be fair about it. Well, now, first, the extreme left. The extreme left, as it really is, not as the John Birch Society imagines it, but as it really is, not hobgoblins and witches, but the real ones, the people really on the extreme left, the kinds of people who import flags from the Viet Cong to be sold in this country to raise money to be shipped back to Ho Chi Minh's government in Hanoi. That's the real left. Now, the real left is a conglomeration of about 150 different movements at the present time, maybe 165 since last I was here, because this one, for example, the U.S. Committee to Aid the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam is a brand new group. It was founded in August of this year. It's brand new in the sense that it's only a couple of months old. So 165 movements, perhaps, numbering about 1,500,000 of our fellow citizens in either a dues-paying role or a closely allied role, in the sense that our fellow travelers can be counted on for contributions, although not necessarily membership. And all of these movements have in common the following. One, they have rejected, this is the extreme left now, they have rejected either the liberal or the conservative approach to American politics. They have lost faith in the system, if indeed they ever had any faith in the system. They've thrown in the towel and they've given up, and they say that we cannot reform America. America is not reformable because America is a sick and decadent society that must go. America, as we know it, must be abolished because there's a better way. There's a superior way. There's a scientific way, if you will. And the scientific way in the minds of the extreme left, as it really is Marxism. Marxian socialism, utopian Marxism, Marxist-Leninism, whatever it may be, but they all share in common, all 165 of these movements, a few of which are represented on the board for you, this belief that Marxism is a pure science, and it's a way of looking at history that is superior to all other ways of looking at history, because Marx had the deepest insights and the profoundest knowledge of human nature. And all we need do is tear up the system as we know it now, not reform it, but tear it up completely, not this orderly and progressive and systematic modification of the system, but a revolutionary change tomorrow, if possible, or next week, or just as soon as possible, whenever the day comes when we can tear our system up by the roots and stick Marxism in its place. Now, a lot of my critics will say to me, you don't really believe that movements like the Young Socialist Alliance on a college campus, or the WED, Du Bois Clubs of America, which is the Communist Party on a college campus, or the Communist Party itself, or the Progressive Labor Party, or any of these other groups. You don't seriously believe that they want to overthrow the government, do you? And the answer is, of course I believe it. I know it to be true, because I've spent all these years delving into their literature, and it doesn't take very long to get the point if you read the literature and read it carefully. Now, if you would interview the leaders of these groups and ask them, they have another story for you. Just as if you interview the John Birch Society members, they have an entirely different story that has no relationship to what they're all about either. Extremists never see themselves as they really are. But the people who run these movements, these revolutionary movements, would overthrow the government tomorrow if they could. Now they can't and they know it, and so they're not about to. But the point is that they would if they could, and that's really the final test. Just as, for example, the final test in the areas of religious freedom in America. Now, I'm a New England Unitarian, so I come from a pretty freewheeling background religiously. I am not bound by some of the dogmas that some religious groups are. But I am totally and completely in favor of religious freedom, and I do a lot of speaking out in particular against anti-Catholicism, which I find personally repugnant because it is so ignorant. And I say to people that the ultimate test of a religious freedom in the United States is that if the Roman Catholics, for example, were to gain the greatest number of Americans, there are about 25 million of them now, but let's say that there was almost no one in the United States who was not Roman Catholic. I am firmly convinced, knowing American Roman Catholics as I do, that everybody who was not in agreement with them, whether it were one or 10 or 10,000, would be free to worship publicly and believe anything that they wish, because American Roman Catholics, like the rest of us, have lived here, understand the American heritage, know something about the meaning of religious freedom, and would in no way restrict Jews and Protestants and Unitarians, I might add, were they to be the dominant voice in a religious sense. So that in that sense, you see, you make this kind of a comparison that if Roman Catholics would, if they could, stamp out all other religions, then they would indeed be a menace. And the extreme right, which hammers away that they are, might have something going for them. But this is not so. On the other hand, the extreme left would overthrow our system if they could. The only thing that prevents them is the sure knowledge that they would be put down. An insurrection of that type would be put down because we are internally strong. We have the armed forces to do it. We have security agencies of the federal government that keep these groups under surveillance. They don't say they can't do what they do, but they keep them under surveillance because they know what they have in mind for the rest of us. So the only distinction I'm making here that is so important for you to know about is that the left, the extreme left as it really exists, is a Marxist organ, talking about the superiority of Marxian socialism, Marxist-Leninism, utopian Marxism, just plain Marxism, whatever it may be, because they believe that our system is rotten and decadent, and they thus become, in my terms, United States system haters. They hate our system in every way possible, and they would destroy us any chance that they would find to do it. The time is not right for them. The time hasn't been right for a very long time, and may indeed never be right. But that is what they have in mind. Now, of course, the argument of the people who get hysterical about this is to say, well, if this is what they have in mind for us, then let's get rid of them before it's too late. Except that our system doesn't function that way. We are a free system. Lots of people would try to get rid of us. Lots of people do not believe in a kind of a mainstream American sense of fair play approach. And we have the kind of a system that says, well, there are two ways of looking at it. Groups are free to advocate anything that they want. Advocacy is one thing, deed is another. Now, if all of these student groups start filling their dormitories, just to mention a few of the Marxist groups, there's been a resurgence of Marxism on college campuses. The Young Socialist Alliance, for example, is a student-oriented group. It's made up of college students. It's the arm of the Socialist Workers' Party, which is its adult group. I could run through a whole series of these left-wing movements. The magazine Insurgent is the monthly magazine of the W.E.B. Du Bois Clubs, or Du Bois Clubs of America. And the W.E.B. Du Bois Clubs of America presently is the Communist Party division on college campuses. It's easier to recruit people under the name of the W.E.B. Du Bois Clubs than it is under the Communist Youth Division. You see, one thing about extremists, they don't like to give their little games away. Imagine somebody walking up and saying, I'm Joe Jones from the Communist Youth Division, I want you to join us. Or walking up and saying to the student government here, I want to infiltrate your group and take it over in the name of international communism. I mean, it's ridiculous. They don't operate this way any more than they do on the extreme right. You'll never find a John Birch Society member going up to a PTA or the League of Women Voters and saying, hey, I'm Carrie Nation from the John Birch Society, and I want to join your PTA and wreck it. if they did that sort of thing, we'd know what it's all about, any more than you can't find any groups that call themselves the Society of Roman Catholic Haters. There are lots of groups that have nothing else in mind but the hatred of Roman Catholics, but there's not a single group in the country called We Hate Roman Catholics Incorporated, or We Hate Jews. So we really have to look at the thing the way it is, and we could run down all of these groups and find that they have interesting ties and connections and all the rest. By the way, I don't think that this is nearly as important as an understanding of the spectrum, which is why I will spend much more time this evening on the spectrum and less time on the individual groups. But many of these movements, however ludicrous they may seem, have in mind for us on the extreme left the business of doing us in at the first quickest possible time. And I think that it is naive on the part of anyone to suggest that it isn't so because you don't like to believe that it is so. And it is very, very evident once somebody delves very deeply into the literature and reads the fine print as well as the obvious print, and also a very, very careful study of their internal party documents. You see, there are many, many arms of extremism. There is a monthly magazine that goes to the broad public and is sold on newsstands. And then there's the internal party document that is for the membership only. And without a study of both, you cannot get the full flavor of what these groups are all about. If you read the internal party documents of the Communist Party, it's one thing. If you read The Worker, it's something else. The Worker is going through a very soft phase, going through a very, very strong coexistence phase. It's in a lot of hot water with the communists in China, as well as elsewhere. And so there's a difference between the approach here and what they publish internally, just as there's a big difference between the monthly members' bulletin of the John Birch Society, which goes to the membership, and the monthly magazine called American Opinion, which you'll find on newsstands. They're both John Birch Society organs, but there is a difference, and that should certainly be understood. Now, the left, for me, is essentially, again, this organ hating the system. And what they're really hating above all else is the profit motive. They say that to attempt to reform our system and say that we can ever educate capitalists is a mistake. That the system is inherently evil because it has a profit motive. The profit motive means the exploitation of man. The exploitation of man means that the rich get rich and the poor get poorer, thus the system has to go. Now, many Marxists, both at the student and adult level, believe this very deeply. And many of them have some smattering of the injustices that do exist under a free economy. No economy is perfect, and there have been injustices down through the decades under our competitive system. Obviously, there have been abuses, as there are abuses in all systems. The imperfections obviously are in man and not in systems, but at any rate, many Marxists believe this very deeply, and it's a mistake, I think, on the part of the critics of the extreme left or the extreme right to assume again that nobody believes this, or how can they believe it? Many of them believe these things very deeply. They believe that the United States is a nation where the rich are getting richer every day and the poor are getting poorer. And you see notices to the effect that men and women are going to bed hungry and starving, and some people are dying in the streets in the United States because of malnutrition and all the rest. Now, this may be a flight from reality, and I believe it is, but that is what they're saying. And above all, I want you to understand these things. I'm not merely lecturing for the sake of hearing myself speak. And so I hammer home certain points that I think are essential, namely that the dedication that one finds on the extremes, the true believers, their ability to change day into night and night into day are all characteristics of extremes on both sides. Now, one other thing before we leave the left, and again, if there were time, I would go clear across the border and tell you that the Militant is the weekly newspaper of the Socialist Workers' Party, challenges the Revolutionary Weekly Newspaper, and it calls itself a Revolutionary Weekly Newspaper, by the way. Sometimes the editors of Challenge say that I smear them by calling them revolutionaries. If you look on the first page, it says Challenge, a Revolutionary Weekly. Now, I don't see how anybody who calls it a Revolutionary Weekly when they have it on the front page can be smearing them. It's like Rockwell, you know, a man who once addressed the assemblage here. Rockwell says, I go around calling him a Nazi. Well, he's the head of the American Nazi Party. I don't see why. It's amazing, you know. All I want to do is be precise in the terminology that I use. And again, Challenge, which is the weekly, revolutionary weekly newspaper of progressive labor, which is a Maoist or a Peking-oriented communist faction, many different kinds. And we had the time to go through all of them and all the 165 that is in time. But one other thing you should know about them, in addition to being system-hating in American terms, zeroing in on the system as the evil, they are something else. And that something else is that they are, quote, people-loving, end of quote. Now, I've used this phrase before, I've used it here before, and I use it over and over again because I think it's applicable to all of the groups. They all claim to be the champion of the common man, that no one bleeds more for the underprivileged in the United States than do the Marxists. And part of their appeal in our society is that they are for the sharecropper and the tenant farmer and the victims of slumlords, as you'll see, I think one of the headlines there deals with. An alleged campaign against slumlords. They're worried about the poverty-stricken. They're worried about the unemployed, the high school dropout, the college dropout, the migratory worker, the old aged, the infirm, the sick, the needy. This is part of their propaganda barrage. Anybody who is exploitable, any issues that are exploitable become very much the target of the Marxist left. That is why, for example, the Vietnamese crisis has brought such a rash of demonstrations. Now, not all the demonstrations against our participation there are communist-inspired, and the great bulk of the people demonstrating are not even communist. But I will tell you this, that there would not have been any demonstrations in the first place if it had been left up to the pacifist alone. By a pacifist, I mean that kind of person who has either a religious, ethical, or moral conviction about the taking of another life. And there are a lot of pacifists in the United States. And many of them have this genuine belief that the commandment that says thou shalt not kill must be obeyed. And there are a lot of people now going around and equating the pacifist with the communist. Well, they're two different traditions. And there were pacifists long before there were communists on the American scene. And it's an old tradition. I don't happen to be a pacifist. And I happen to think that pacifists are very mistaken about the nature of totalitarianism. That unless they come to grips with the nature of totalitarianism, they will never fully understand why it is necessary sometimes to fight for freedom. But aside from that, I don't make the mistake of equating the two. Well, a number of these demonstrations were sparked by pacifists, but there were a larger number sparked by the same newspapers and publications representing extreme left-wing communist groups that you see on the board before you. Because that is an exploitable issue. The communists in the United States have always been on the side of communist revolutions from without. The Castro Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Chinese Civil War, and so on. They have always favored any communist regime. And so they naturally favor the North Vietnamese government or the Viet Cong. They favor them in this particular setting because obviously they want that country reunited under the leadership of Ho Chi Minh. And that is why the demonstrations were aimed not at everybody's participation there, not at the participation of Chinese technicians and assistants from Red China, and not at Ho Chi Minh's government bombing the American embassy in Saigon and the use of terror and the murder and the looting and the terror of the Viet Cong. One would think, for example, that if one is going to be against terror in Vietnam, one would be against terror clear across the board, or killing clear across the board. The very fact that the demonstrations were aimed only at our participation, it seems to me, should have given all of us some cause for concern. Why not? A demonstration aimed at everybody's participation. End the war. Negotiate on all sides. But no, we were the heavy, we were the villain, and the reason is that aside from the pacifists who were demonstrating, the bulk of the others behind the scenes were the hardcore communist revolutionaries, and then they picked up the usual complement of people who go along sometimes for the ride, or who go along partly, or the students who are very excitable on this issue, since many of them face the draft very soon. And then there were a lot of other people who got involved in these things, independent peace groups, Quakers, and so on. So that was an exploitable issue and a typical one. Well, now, this people-loving emphasis on the left is terribly important to understand if you're going to understand the appeal of Marxists. Because they managed to turn issues kind of inside out. And rather than have anybody in our system look at themselves and say, that's me I'm looking at in the mirror,
And I didn't make it, or I failed because of inadequacies or lack of preparation or stupidity or laziness or fumbling the ball or whatever the case may be. The communists give you something to project on and to project outward with. Namely, they blame it on the system. You see, you drop out of college not because you couldn't make the grade, but because we have a system. We have an educational hierarchy that's in the grip of Wall Street and the imperialists. And all the deans and all the college presidents and the rest are part of a system that is going to squeeze down the talented student and grind them down because it's inevitable. You see, all of these things are inevitable because the system is so evil. And then they become the great champions of the underprivileged in this kind of a context. Now, before we leave the left, and we're about to leave it now, let me caution you about my total disbelief in this kind of people loving. There's nothing like saying this and then having someone next week write a letter to the next school that I visit and say, you know what he said about the communists, that they're a bunch of, they're the only people who love people. I'm maybe talking about it in a propagandistic sense. If you want to understand why they have an appeal, it's because they're exploiting that which is exploitable on the American scene. I don't accept this for a moment. I'm well aware of the fact that in every instance when the communists have seized power, anywhere in the world, the very working man that they're supposed to liberate is immediately placed in chains if he hadn't been there before. And in some cases, in the case of East Germany, the Nazis had the working man in chains, and then the communists took over that sector in East Germany, and they kept the working man in chains. And if they found him out of chains, they put him back in. There isn't a Marxist economy in the world, a Marxist-run country, a communist-run country that allows the man to strike, the working man, to engage in collective bargaining, to vote in free elections. And forced labor is very often the norm in all of these places. Castro is now transporting workers from one province to another to fill in on jobs that he thinks should be done, the building of a tuna fleet, for example. And a lot of cane workers, sugar cane workers, who have no interest in building a tuna fleet, are now forced to work in other areas away from their families because Castro wants a tuna fleet. Well, this sort of thing would never happen in a free society like our own, or let's hope that it would never happen at least. It hasn't happened, no reason to believe it ever would. But this certainly makes a mockery out of their defense of a little fellow. The same little fellow they're going to liberate, they always manage to put in chains. But in terms of understanding why they would appeal to people, why they would appeal, for example, to a sensitive college student, you should understand that a lot of college students lack experience. They have a lot of idealism. The idealism can be exploited, and they wind up sometimes on the wrong side of the fence on a good many of these issues. Wrongheadedness, yes, but that certainly isn't the same thing as selling out to the other side. And many of the college students who march against what we're doing in one area or another are doing it out of a sense of morality and deep conviction about the need to do something about making the world a better place than the adult world has made it. Now the extreme right. You get immediately into an area that is different from the left in almost every way, shape, and form. To begin with, it's an orbit outside of the conservative tradition, just as the left is an orbit outside the liberal tradition. There's no more relationship to the conservatives and the extreme right than there is to the liberals and the extreme left. And let's make sure you get that much straight, because conservatives are not extremists. Extremists are extremists, not conservatives. Now, the extreme right is directionally different from the left. It's way over here as opposed to being way over here. And rather than hating the system that we live under, the extreme right believes it's the only system anywhere in the world. And it's kind of what might loosely be described as an American uber alles concept, that we ought to impose our way of life on everybody, whether they want it or not. And by God, if they don't like the way we do things, in other words, you know, you give aid only to those countries that would be willing to play by our rules of the game. You only help those in need in other parts of the world if they give us a commitment to aid us in a time of stress or something else. I'm sure you know that type of thinking. It's a very rigid kind of thinking. And the problem with the extreme right is that while their patriotism per se is not to be brought into question, the quality of their patriotism certainly is. Nobody loves America more than an outfit like the John Birch Society, and nobody understands it less. They are like the doting parents of the son and the daughter who wildly love their children and haven't even the remotest idea of what their children are all about. And as a result, their children spend their summers in Europe, anything to get away from home. Or they go east, or they go south, or west, depending where the parents live. And I'm sure many of you know about it. I meet parents all the time that haven't seen their children for 4 and 5 years. Some of them go home for one day at Christmas and spend the rest of the Christmas vacation elsewhere. And their parents are at a great loss when they say, "Oh, I love my son and my daughter. Why is this? Why does this happen?" Well, again, it's a question of loving, but love's not enough. And loving America is meaningless if it's the kind of thing that isn't tempered with understanding and compassion and all the rest. And thus the John Birches, as a kind of a symbol of the extreme right, are filled with this sort of thing. They haven't a glimmering of what made this country great, and they haven't a glimmering of what keeps this country great. They haven't even a glimmering of what democracy is all about. In fact, they completely and totally scorn democracy. Now, I want to spend just a little bit of time on the Birch Society, and I've got to get my glasses out for this, as an entity on the extreme right, because while the American Nazi Party leader was here to speak on campus, I hardly think that Billings is about to succumb to the Nazi Party virus, but I think there's some evidence that obviously you have some Birches here, and there are some Birches in the Montana area. In fact, I heard some things today in a number of different places that would indicate to me that they've been trying to do some organizing in this area, so it might be worthwhile to spend a little time on them. Now, the thing that immediately separates the extreme right, whether it's the Birch Society or any other group, from the conservative side, is in the very crucial area of the employment of parliamentary procedures and the democratic process. The genuine conservative, worried above all else about the growth of government and bureaucracy and the usurpation of power by a federal or a state government, knows that the way to block this is to employ at every turn all the parliamentary procedures that one can marshal. And every decent conservative in the United States, in the business community or anywhere else, has a great comprehension of what parliamentary procedures are all about. In the city of Akron, Ohio, where I've been a number of times to do the Chambers of Commerce and Rotary and the Associated Industry Groups and all the rest, there is a great battle for power there between steel and rubber and other American industries. There are a lot of different corporations involved. Now, the Chamber of Commerce could easily become, in a sense, the tool of the rubber industry, with the rubber industry calling all the shots, because that's what is really big in Akron. But steel and other groups compete with them, and thus, in the various industrial organizations, they scrupulously employ parliamentary procedures. So one year when I speak there, one man introduces me, and the next year somebody else introduces me, and the former president is now out in the audience along with everybody else, because the turnover of personnel, nominating committees, parliamentary maneuvers, and all the rest are essential. Just as in your student council here, you don't have one president for 4 years, and if you do, you're crazy, take my word for it, and had nothing to do with your current president. He's a charming guy, I had supper with him tonight. But that has nothing to do with it. You just wouldn't be caught dead doing that any more than the League of Women Voters, or the Council of Churches, or any of the other groups that operate in this broad mainstream that we've been talking about, know and fully appreciate the need for the democratic process, because that's part and parcel of the whole American heritage. Now, without exception on the extreme right, without exception, every movement is dominated by one man, was brought into being by one man, and is ruled from the top down, and parliamentary procedures are not only put aside, but they're laughed at as unnecessary and as harmful and all the rest. This would apply to the John Birch Society, it would apply to the American Nazi Party, it would apply to the Ku Klux Klan, the Christian Crusade, go all the way down the line if you wish. You'll just find them all along the line on the extreme right. Now, they have a right to set up any kind of monolithic authoritarian body that they want, but they haven't the right to confuse this with conservatism. The extreme right is authoritarian, just as the extreme left is authoritarian, and there's no relationship whatever to conservatism. Now, let me quote the Blue Book. And Birches themselves will tell me that when I quote the Blue Book, this is fair play. Even Mr. Wells says, yes, it's in the Blue Book, it's policy of the Birch Society. It's very hard, by the way, to find out what their policy is. They're so structured that they can deny almost everything. You know, a man like former Congressman Russolo gets on television for an interview, and the average television newsman, even a Walter Cronkite, for all of his competency, does not have the basic documents of the Birch Society in front of him. So when he says to Mr. Russolo, "Is it true that you're a monolithic authoritarian structure?" Russolo will say, "Well, some of our critics say that we are," and he starts into a long harangue, and rather than answer the question, well, then the question just hangs, you see. Or is it true that Mr. Welch called Eisenhower a communist, and then you get the usual denials of this? That isn't really what he said at all. Well, it's all in black and white, and I never go anywhere without taking the documents with me, whether they're on the left or the right, because this is where arguments are finally settled. And let's see what they really did say on the business of what America is all about in terms of the way the John Birch Society would have us run it. The John Birch Society is to be a monolithic body. Democracy is merely a deceptive phrase, a weapon of demagoguery, and a perennial fraud. The John Birch Society will operate under completely authoritative controls at every level, for we mean business every step of the way. There are reasons why, in the fight ahead, we cannot stop for parliamentary procedures of any kind or allow a lot of arguments among ourselves. End of quote. Across the page. Actually, the John Birch Society will cut through the red tape and parliamentary briar patches and roadblocks of confused purpose by exercising direct authority at every turn. The men who join the John Birch Society during the next few months or few years are going to do so because they believe in me and what I'm doing and are willing to accept my leadership anyway. We'll not tolerate factions developing on the two sides to every question theme. Members who cease to feel a necessary degree of loyalty can either resign or we'll put them out. As I've said, we mean business every step of the way. Whenever differences of opinion become translated into a lack of loyal support, we'll find the shortcut for eliminating both, and we won't bother with any Congress of so-called parliamentary procedures or the democratic process. End of quote. Well, now, there's nothing so-called about parliamentary procedures in American political life or in American social or business life either, and there's nothing so-called about the democratic process. Without parliamentary procedures, without the application of the democratic process, any movement, large or small, political, social, business, religious, or anything else, would lapse into authoritarianism and eventually totalitarianism. If you had a president of a student council on campus who said, the day he set foot on campus as a freshman, "I'm going to run things my way," and you couldn't remove him until he graduated, you would have a tyrannical situation, however mild it may seem in a mild setting such as a college campus. But translate this, if you will, into a larger area of American political life, and you can see how really dangerous all of this becomes. So by their own words, they mock and scorn the parliamentary process and the democratic process, and this is why conservatives in particular, from Senator Milton Young to Senator Everett Dirksen and others, are denouncing the John Birch Society and asking the Birches to stay out of the Republican Party and stop infiltrating it. Because again, you have people in the Republican Party who are also Birches, but they tell you that they are only Republicans. Again, they're not saying, "I'm a member of the John Birch Society and I want to run the Republican Party." If they did, they wouldn't have a chance. But when they operate in a kind of secrecy and all the rest, they certainly can. I might add, by the way, that in October of 1963, along with another fellow, I prepared a piece for the Saturday Evening Post called "Inside the So-Called Student Trips to Cuba." This was in relationship to a 1963 visit of some students from Progressive Labor, who did not go down under the auspices of Progressive Labor, because that would have given the whole thing away. They went down under the phony name of the Permanent Student Committee for Travel to Cuba, whatever that may be. It's an arm of Progressive Labor which rented a post office box for a couple of months. Well, interestingly enough, I sent along a boy on this trip for the very express purpose of finding out what happens when Castro agrees to bring down several hundred college students from America, pay all the bills for them, and attempt to indoctrinate them with his special form of Marxist-Leninism. And I found a young student in the Boston area who went along on this trip. with a full knowledge, I might add, of the FBI and the security agencies of the federal government. In fact, since that time, both myself and this boy have been government witnesses in a trial involving passport fraud. We won't get into that. That's a separate subject. But at any rate, while there, this particular student, his name is Barry Hoffman, interviewed Fidel Castro and asked Castro about free elections and when was he going to do something about having free elections. This was during a student press conference. And Castro told him, he said, "You people in the United States with your so-called parliamentary procedures and your so-called democratic process, it's interesting how totalitarians on both sides always refer to things like parliamentary procedures as a waste of time." Castro told us, "Well, we don't need free elections in Cuba. I'd win anyway." You know, which freely translated means I won't take the chance, but this is the rationale. He says, "We're busy wiping out illiteracy. We're busy stamping out medical diseases of all types. We haven't got time for free elections. You and your so-called parliamentary procedures in the United States." Then you turn to the extreme right, and you're the authoritarian right, and you read Robert Welch and his deluded followers in the John Birch Society, and they say the same thing. Also, on the subject of comparisons, Progressive Labor sent the communist students to Cuba under the title of the Student Committee for Travel to Cuba, which now turns out, I shouldn't say now because I broke the story way back in the fall of 63, that this was merely a puppet organization, a front for the Chinese communists in the United States. And on page 86 in the Blue Book, Mr. Wells tells the followers the following, quote, "The John Birch Society will organize front groups, little fronts, big fronts, temporary fronts, permanent fronts, all kinds of front organizations, just like the communists. You see, the communists have their hidden movements, and so the Birches will set up there." So sometimes if you hear about a movement around the Billings area called the Committee to Warn of the Arrival of Communist Merchandise on the Local Business Scene, you know, you get these silly little groups that want to get Russian caviar out of the supermarkets on the basis that this is the way to really hurt the communists, is to ship all the caviar back to the Soviet Union, although most of it is manufactured here, I might add, or get Polish hams out of the A&P. That's the John Birch's version of defeating communism. You can be almost certain that a group under that title is one of the many, many front groups. They have a new one called TAC, which is supposed to be the truth about civil rights turmoil. And it was created and put into motion by the John Birch Society. They have a whole pile of little front groups. And then they wonder why they're so roundly and severely criticized in the press. They copy the authoritarian communists at every turn because they themselves are authoritarians. And whatever may be their intentions, they wind up copying the very totalitarians they're supposed to oppose. A final thing on the extreme right before we wrap this up. Unlike the left, emphasizing people loving, the extreme right emphasizes people hating. The organized assaults against Jews because they are Jews, Negroes because they are Negroes, Catholics because they are Catholics, various ethnic groups because they happen not to be so-called majority groups, all of this is the exclusive property of the extreme right. When you get this exalted idea that only you are a good American, it's a short step, in my judgment, to banging people over the head because they happen to go to a different church, or they happen to have a swarthy complexion or something of the sort. And if we had the time, I could go into reams and reams of copy showing the Birch Society making references to Italians as Dagos and Guineas and Wops in one of their publications, references to a Senate committee investigation of the John Birch Society on the West Coast, which has very recently been released, showing that in California alone, the alarming growth of Jew baiting within the John Birch Society has caused the California Senate committee, which a couple of years ago took a different view of the Birch Society, to re-examine its position and say that the John Birch Society is housing fanatics of a racial and religious type, and that there's an increase in all kinds of bigotry in the ranks of the John Birch Society in California. And the Senate conducted an investigation of the chapters there and found an alarming growth of bigotry and hatred within the ranks of this group. Well, I charge that this is inevitable. These things are so structured that they attract people of that type. They're forever attracting people with these ideas that somehow to be white and blue-eyed and Anglo-Saxon is somehow supposed to be the real essence of Americanism. I might add, by the way, one of the reasons that they have such an intense hatred of me in the Bird Society is because they claim that I've sold out my biological birthright, which I don't even know what they're talking about, but they claim that I've sold it out. I'm Scotch and English, and, you know, and what else I may be, I don't know, but I imagine that's about it, and yet I fail to see how this makes me any different from Floyd Patterson or anybody else, except I think I'm a better fighter than he is. I don't get the distinctions that they seem to be drawing all along the line. And yet, in the Blue Book of the John Bird Society, in dealing with me, Mr. Welch writes, in a very long section devoted to wrecking my meetings, there are dozens of slimy characters loose in America, whom I'll call to your attention by describing one who is more or less typical. His usual name is Gordon Hall. You know, the inference that maybe I'm not what I claim I am. Though he uses and has used many different aliases. And then it says, he and his fellow toilers for the communists, and then it goes on to outline how to wreck my meetings, which, by the way, this is what it is that prompts people in a town like Billings to make the phone calls to the local stations and all the rest. They get out their little blue books and they study them, and the directives are all here. You see, these are the great individualists who are acting individually in concert with somebody up in Belmont, Massachusetts. There's nothing like the individualism of the John Birch Society. They do everything according to an agenda, and it's spread out. But one of the things that I find interesting here is that Mr. Wells says that I use aliases, which is completely untrue, I might add. A lot of people help me. I have a whole army of people of all descriptions who get mail for me because I can't get mail on my own from these groups, and people will write mail for me from Seattle, Washington, or some other place, and then turn the various publications over to me so I can keep up to date on them. But these are real people writing for them. They're not aliases. But the John Birch Society, by its own admission, on page 86 in the Blue Book, in a long, long section, says, we will create all kinds of front organizations, little ones, big ones, temporary ones, permanent ones, all kinds of vague movements to further our ends. These are all aliases of the John Birch Society. They are set up by the Birch Society under phony names with post office boxes scattered all over the country. And then he turns around and accuses me of using aliases, which is completely untrue. And then he goes on, of course, to tell the followers how to go out and wreck my meetings. And there's nothing like having a Birch break up one of my meetings and then tell me how much they believe in the Bill of Rights. You know, that's really, you know, it's like a man chopping down a redwood tree in California and then standing on the stump to give a speech about the glories of conservation. That is the spectrum as I see it in more than sketchy outline. I took much longer than I thought I would, and I would insist that what you really have here in the United States, in an operative political sense, are liberals and conservatives filled with imperfection and all the rest, but characterized in the broad middle by system supporting. Neither liberals nor conservatives have lost faith in this system of ours to endure and to compete and to win, if necessary, in international contests. And in that sense, they certainly form the mainstream, and they are characterized by providing alternatives and change, all within the framework of a democratic society. The left is characterized by this insistence that Marxism is a pure science, which it is not, and they fight among themselves over who is the correct interpreter of this pure science. You know, if there is such a thing as a pure science, and there are pure sciences, they are subject not to a lot of different interpretations. There's no such thing, for example, as Russian mathematics or Chinese mathematics or German mathematics. There may be varying schools of approaches and all the rest, but mathematics, by and large, remains mathematics. Well, Marxism is subject to so many different interpretations because it is such a fraud, both as history and as economics and as science. It may be a lot of things, but it is not history in the sense that it is a predictable kind of way of looking at life and it never changes. I can't begin to recite the errors in Marx's interpretation of the advancing Western societies. Marx was so wrong about the United States in particular that we could spend all night just talking about that. But they insist on the left that this is what it's all about, and it has turned them against the United States. They are system haters, but their propaganda reeks of people loving. The far right is characterized by authoritarianism and the lack, total absence of parliamentary procedures, and the racial and religious bigotry that I mentioned just a few moments ago. Now, briefly, those of you who want to do something about this kind of thing in Billings or elsewhere, those of you who are sufficiently aroused about it to be concerned and perhaps want to go further, you are welcome to write to me if you'd like to have the materials that I have quoted from this evening and the materials on the board before you. I make deals with my audiences. I don't quote out of context. I don't lift things for my own purposes. I don't tell you that the John Birch Society is creating fronts. I prove it to you by sending the literature to you. And I can do this because I collect all of this in simply staggering quantities on the simple assumption that the more that I collect, the less they're able to distribute. I have plenty to go around for all of you. I have plenty to go around for all of you, and I think last time, I think I received a total of about 18 or 20 letters altogether, which for a very small audience was really quite good, and I believe, with one possible exception, that I couldn't make out the address, I think that I ultimately acknowledged every one of those letters, and some of you may be here tonight. I know of some people here tonight who did receive bundles from me. It's without charge. It doesn't cost me anything to collect these materials, so in turn I don't charge you for them. And you are welcome to write to me and get the Marxist publications and the Birchite publications and the Stormtrooper of the Nazi Party and the Klan literature and all the rest. And I'll happily forward this to you. I need a little time sometimes to get this in the mail because I'm busy and I travel a great deal and I'm in the height of my lecture season right now. But ultimately, you will receive it if you have the patience. And all I need from you is a written request. And my address is on file here at school. And I also have some extra copies of the Chamber of Commerce reprint that has my address, my home address on the back, and I'll put them out and you can take them with you if you wish, and that way you don't have to get the address from school. Now that's one way of pursuing the subject matter in greater detail and checking up on the accuracy of what I've been telling you this evening. But beyond that, I would say that if you don't like extremism, as I don't like extremism, and if you want to do something about it, there is no need, in my judgment, to immediately think in terms of forming a student organization to combat extremism at Rocky Mountain College or in downtown Billings or something else. What this country doesn't need is any more organizations of any kind, believe me. We ought to call a moratorium on groups and strengthen the groups that do exist. Now, if your cup of tea is international understanding, there are international relations clubs, there are world affairs councils, there are Pan-American societies, there are English-speaking unions, there are just a myriad of organizations that would increase one's knowledge of the rest of the world in addition to just some good history courses and some good solid reading on your own. So that's one way of enlarging your own frame of reference in the area of, let's say, international problems. If you don't like bigotry, then you can try working for justice along the lines of race, creed, and color. And there are dozens of legitimate and responsible organizations in the field of interrace and interreligious activities. And there's no need for more of these. Or you can just try to think through some of your own bigoted notions about other people on the grounds of race, color, or creed. And if you don't like bigotry, try making brotherhood work. There are any number of things that we can all do. There's no need for me to stand here now and say that this is the problem and now this is what you will all do, because you will all do what you have to do. I am not the kind of a lecturer that offers solutions for problems. I would rather raise problems and get you thinking about them, because there are no miracle drug solutions for problems of this type. We have always had extremists. In my judgment, we probably always will, because it's one of the risks that a free society takes in order to remain free. Now we could, and I suppose some people want us to, say that no people have the right to tell lies about other people. Slander and character assassination and all the rest have no place in American life, therefore we'll have a law in the books that will abolish this. But keep in mind that the people who make these charges very often believe them. And Robert Welch in particular believes that President Eisenhower is a communist. And a very dedicated one. He thinks he's been in the party for 30 years, and his superior in the party is his brother Milton, which compounds the nonsense. He happens to be dead wrong. I know he's dead wrong, and I hope that you know he's dead wrong. President Eisenhower's loyalty is beyond reproach in terms of his service to his country, his service to his political party and all the rest. You may question his wisdom, or you may question a lot of things about him, but his integrity and his patriotism certainly is beyond reproach, and there's not a shred of evidence anywhere to show that he's working for the Russians and that he's been in the Communist Party. However, since Mr. Welsby believes that, you see, it becomes truth to him, falsehood, I hope, to the rest of us. So the answer then rests in elevating public opinion, and the way to elevate public opinion is to work at it to the point where most of us, at least, will be able to distinguish between liberals and communists on one side, the conservatives and the extreme right on the other, tell the difference between fiction and fact, falsehood and truth, modern Republicans and communists and so on. And this is the hope, really, for free people, is that education is meaningful and that people can be taught to take the pains to find out just what it is that is the truth in any given situation. And that is a much safer course, in my judgment, than saying that they can't do this because it's wrong or they haven't the right to use the mails. They have every right to do anything that they want just so long as they stay within the framework of the law. This government of ours draws a very, very big line between advocating something and then the deed to do it. And if students here or anywhere else decided to fill up the dorms with machine guns for the revolution, then I'm sure that the officials downtown would certainly take notice, the law enforcement agencies. But you're free to advocate revolution, all kinds of things, as long as the advocacy stays advocacy and you don't actually put these things into effect. Just as Rocco, for example, is free to advocate the liquidation of Jews, but the moment that he harms an individual Jew in this country, he will be subject to prosecution. And that's the way it should be with free people. So now, questions I would hope from... is it okay if I take the director before him, or do you want to bother?
I wanted to say something.
He wanted to say something first, so I'll kind of fall back to
fix. I want to thank you, and I want to thank the student body for making it possible for you to be here, and I'm sure that all these people here will want me to say this. It is at 9:45. Mr. Hall has been up since 5:00 this morning, Eastern Standard Time, which makes it about midnight back east now. And it's been a long day, and I would only say that I hope that you will remember that he is the one who's being paid to make the speeches. And if you have any questions to ask, you're welcome to ask them.
Now that you're all thoroughly intimidated, let's go. Who has a question? Yes?
Could you elaborate on maybe this is off the little theme of your argument? We're talking about the main theme with regard to your notion of the liberal conservatives, the liberal leading citizen man, and the conservatives to kind of think of the man.
Gentleman wants me to elaborate on the beginning part, the business of liberals and the essential goodness of man theme and conservatives believing in contradiction. Yes, I would say that liberals believe in the goodness of man when the conditions are right. They do not believe, for example, that if people... Well, let's take, for example, the liberals' attitude about aiding Latin America. Liberals are very, very strong for the Alliance for Progress and pumping a lot of money into Latin America on the assumption that if we can create better conditions through all sorts of technical assistance and so on, give, if you will, the Latin American economy some American know-how in farming and industry and so on, that the standard of living will be elevated and then the conditions there will be such that the average Latin American peasant, rather than grubbing out a living and being subjected to military dictatorships, communist dictatorships, the lure of Castroism and so on, that once the average peasant there is no longer forced to grub out a living day to day, and he can feed his family, maybe send them to school and all the rest, that this man in turn will show his very positive side and will adopt democratic ways of doing things and won't be a sucker for a Juan Perón. Or a Batista, or a Castro, or something else. So the theme, basically, in my judgment, is one of the liberal insisting that before we can show our very positive side, that we all have in abundance, the conditions must be right. In other words, if, let's assume for the sake of argument that the dormitories are very cold here. Now, maybe they're not. Mine wasn't where I'm staying, but let's assume that in days gone by at this college or other colleges that the dormitory rooms were freezing, which isn't conducive to good study in the wintertime in Montana, or Boston for that matter. A liberal would argue that, well, we'll have federal aid to education and we'll get new boilers put in. Now, this is an exaggeration, of course, but this is what they're thinking, that under optimum conditions, most students will behave well, and they will put their best foot forward, and so on. Now, this may be the most utopian kind of idealism, and it may not be right, and it may be an incorrect view of the nature of men, but this is what liberals believe in, and that's why they believe so much in political reform, because they think the wider the opportunity, the more civilized we will all become, and the more civilized we will all become, the better the chances for the whole human condition, the whole human race. Now, the conservative argues that this is just buoyant optimism that has nothing to do with what we really are. That you, well, for example, the conservative says, take Franklin Roosevelt. He said in the 1930s that if we have one-third of the nation ill-fed, ill-clothed, and ill-housed, let's do something about this, and we'll see that all of the things that we associate with industrial democracies, high crime, alcoholism, the works, suicides and all the rest will all vanish. Well, now, the conservative will say that in 1965, we no longer have one-third of the nation going to bed, ill-fed, ill-clothed, and ill-housed, and so on. And we have pockets of poverty, but this is now the exception. This is not the rule in American life. And I would agree with the conservatives that whatever, however bad poverty may be in certain areas, that it is the exception. It is not the rule in American life today. And yet the conservative will argue, despite the fact that this is the exception, we still have an enormous amount of drinking and debauchery and all the rest. We have people, one out of every two American marriages ends in divorce. And this, the conservative will argue, is because we are a contradictory kind of people, because we're part of the human race, and to be human is to be filled with uncertainty and despair as well as optimism, and the sum total of all of us is ambiguity, where a lot of things are going for us. We have tigers in us as well as lions, and we have to fight to keep the tiger down. We have ambitious streaks, but we all have indolent streaks, where we'd rather lay on the sand and sun ourselves than work. All of these things are part and parcel of all of us, and the conservative says that that being the case, limitations of government is the first order of business, because you never can be certain. For example, they'll say Lyndon Johnson may have the best intentions. When he gets into the White House, he may become drunk with power, or John F. Kennedy, or Barry Goldwater, anybody. And maybe campaign promises will be nothing but promises, because when a man gets in there, he likes the good life, and he forgets about his service to mankind. There's no guarantee we'll be governed wisely and benevolently, argues the conservative, because man is a contradiction, men and women alike. And that is what I mean by that. These are the guidelines. Now, there are people who disagree that this isn't the way it is at all. But all I would suggest that you do is read. Read Goldwater, if you will. Goldwater's essential theme is limited government. He's more worried about the growth of government than anything else. He worries more about that than international communism. That's something he worries about all the time. He went down south at the height of the Selma Montgomery marches, gave his first major talk after the defeat in 64, spoke in Augusta, Georgia, and he spoke about not Martin Luther King and the marches and Sheriff Jim Clark. Sheriff Jim Clark, by the way, of Selma, Alabama, is now the number one John Birch Society lecturer in the country. He's out on tour for the right as of this moment. He's talking on law enforcement. Support your local police. Kind of an interesting wrinkle. But at any rate, Barry Goldwater in Augusta, Georgia, on that particular night, chose as his theme not the burning race issue, not the marches and all the rest, and the charges and countercharges on both sides, but Barry Goldwater chose as his theme that if we don't do something about the size of the federal government, we'll all be doomed by 1975. That we will be living under a police state. He never even mentioned the race question, speaking at the same time that people were marching from Selma to Montgomery, and the Attorney General of the United States was having emergency all-night meetings and all that, the whole nation was tense because of the potential race conflict. And Goldwater spoke in the South and chose to speak on the limitations of the powers of government because he's that kind of a conservative. He is a conservative. This is what concerns him. And he's certainly being true to his conservative creed. Maybe short-sighted not to touch on this other thing, but this is all I meant by that. And I would say if you study the materials on both sides, the arguments ultimately come back to this every time. These are the two root ideas and everything else. Now, liberals and conservatives are lots of other things, too. But everything that they do stems directly from these views rather than coming back to them. They're an outgrowth of these basic positions. And I think that maybe if you think about what you think yourself, you may be able to decide whether you are a liberal or a conservative. Now, it's possible, by the way, to be both. I happen to be, in practical political terms, I happen to think that the war on poverty is probably a good idea. Because there are a lot of things that need to be done in terms of taking care of inadequate people. I wish that people were not inadequate, but they are. But in philosophical terms, I completely accept the conservative position. They seem to be much closer to reality in talking about contradiction than the essential goodness of man. I think it'd be nice if we all were essentially good. But in my judgment, my own personal view is that it doesn't add up that way at all. It's much more realistic to look upon people as being many, many thrust, not just overwhelmingly good. Although certainly the liberal position has carried us a long way and has been the dominant voice in American politics. Question? Yes?
I realize you plan to speak only in the broad spectrum, but as an expert in extremism, what is your comment, if any, on Mark Lane as the spokesman for the group that believes the Warren Report was not valid?
I consider Mark Lane a fanatic. I consider Mark Lane a prisoner of his own Marxist dogma. He's been part and parcel of the extreme left for as far back as I can remember. He's pretty much out of the National Guardian Associates, which is a weekly newspaper that calls itself a progressive news weekly, but which is a long-time communist newspaper in this country. In fact, the original founder of the National Guardian, Cedric Belford, was deported. He's a citizen of Great Britain and a member of the Communist Party in Great Britain, came to this country to help found the National Guardian, which Lane is a part of it. And Belford was deported for lying about his membership in the British Communist Party when it was discovered he was deported under one of the more recent legislative acts. Now, my feeling about Lane and the Kennedy assassination would be as follows. That while there may be some criticisms leveled at certain conducts of the investigation, the allowing, for example, of a ruby to be in the Dallas police station and so on. There are many, many areas where there's a good deal of sloppiness and inaccuracies and so on. But the main body of the 26 volumes, which I have read, of the Warren Commission report, the meticulous detail, the uncovering of every possible avenue that might have shown us that Oswald was acting in consort with somebody or was indeed innocent or was framed or something, is poppycock. The sheer weight of the evidence against Oswald as the killer, as the man who actually pulled the trigger, was just so overwhelming that whatever may have been your views before you go to it, maybe you thought he was framed, maybe you didn't, maybe you thought he was guilty as guilty could be, but anybody studying the 26 volumes, unless they had a completely closed mind, could only conclude that Oswald indeed did act alone and did pull the trigger and was the assassin. Now, I think that a much more reliable analysis of the 26 volumes and of the whole case would be Dwight MacDonald's Esquire piece of last August. Dwight MacDonald did a voluminous piece, much longer than the Mark Lane pieces, on an analysis of the Warren Commission report and his own investigation. Now, Dwight MacDonald is a socialist, not very happy about President Kennedy, not very happy about liberals, a very disaffected kind of a socialist, and himself a left winger. And yet he dismisses Mark Lane as Mark Lane's case as the ratings of a madman who deliberately is distorting the record to prove his point and to make capital for the communists themselves. And now I know Lane goes around and speaks a good deal, although much less now than he did right after the assassination. And I have studied it very carefully, and I think that
he makes a great to-do about the fact that the Warren Commission people didn't want to have him testify over and over again and get before them. Well, this is kind of a shallow argument. He infers from this that the reason that they didn't want him is because they knew he knew too much. Well, this is ridiculous. It's like I go out to speak in Hamilton and some local bircher wants to debate me there. Well, I'm not going to pick on a local barber or something like that. If John Russolo will debate me or if Mr. Welch will debate me, I would come back here and pay my own way and sit up here on the platform with Welch just so you could see the head of the John Birch Society in the flesh and see how really ludicrous he is. But I'm not going to debate a helpless man. So Lane, like a lot of people, will say, well, the reason that they won't do this is because they're afraid of me. Well, I get challenged every day in the week on the telephone to debate somebody from a nudist colony or some such. Really, I'm not joking. Everybody wants to debate me. Well, I haven't got time. Rockwell, wherever I speak, well, not wherever, but 9 out of 10 schools that I speak in, Rockwell sends letters to the president asking for equal time. He's trying to muscle in on my platform. By the way, speaking of the birches again for just a moment, this is an aside, but you see where Ronald Reagan has recently come out running, he's running hard for the governorship of California, and he says now that doesn't want the support of the John Birch Society. He studied, by the way, that California document that I mentioned, the one of the Senate committee on the West Coast showing the birches to be involved with a lot of hate mongers and so on. And he said he is now taking the position he doesn't want the support of the birches because he's discovered that they've been infiltrated and taken over by lunatics. So I sent him a night letter. I said, "Dear Mr. Reagan, I regard you as a genuine conservative and I wish you well in your political battles and all the rest, and I'm a longtime fan of yours as one who likes the movies. But I think you're mistaken. That outfit hasn't been overtaken and infiltrated by lunatics. It was founded by one." Now, you have a second question on this, I see.
Yeah, the sequel to this committee in England is the Who Killed Kennedy Society, headed by what Bertrand Russell was. Do you have any comment on that?
Sure. Bertrand Russell was the head of a lot of things. I would recommend very strongly to you, and I'm not trying to be facetious, but you want to read an interesting article on Bertrand Russell, read something called The Two Bertrand Russells in a book called Great Companions by Max Eastman. Max Eastman was an old Bolshevik himself in the old days, and both he and Russell visited the Soviet Union way back in the shortly after the revolution, and they struck up a friendship, and they have mutual respect and yet great differences politically now. And he does an interesting analysis of Bertrand Russell, who has injected himself into every single issue of international importance since the beginning of time. And he's always an authority on every issue that he moves into. And when you get right down to it, most of the things that he comments upon, he never even bothered to read. I would wager any amount of money that Bertrand Russell has not read the Warren Commission report. But would pontificate on it. I saw him on the Merv Griffin show. I don't know whether you get the Merv Griffin show out here. Merv had him on for about 45 minutes. It was an excellent interview. But he was pontificating about things that he knew absolutely nothing about the Deep South that he's never even visited. He was an expert on the Deep South. The same thing is true of Albert Schweitzer, the late Albert Schweitzer. Albert Schweitzer is on a letterhead of a dozen or more communist movements in the United States. His name has been loaned to all kinds of groups. Sometimes a group with 15 members and they get a message in some foreign language from him through an intermediary saying that yours is the voice of America, I wish you well and keep up the work for peace. Here's a revolutionary movement called Spartacists with about 15 members. It's an offshoot of three or four other offshoots over here. And Albert Schweitzer, who knows nothing about American politics, never knew anything about American politics, endorses the group. Albert Schweitzer's name and Bertrand Russell's name show up over and over and over again in movements of all descriptions, left and right. It's a curious thing. They're the great name lenders of all history. And I feel that this is just more of the same. But again, Albert Schweitzer, quite frankly, doesn't know anything about American politics. In fact, he doesn't speak English, for one thing. And I think if he'd been to this country once in his life, it was a lot. He's been buried in an isolated kind of a circumstance, devoted to his craft and to his work. I'm not minimizing his great contribution
in other areas. That's something else. But why we assume that because the Who Killed Kennedy group in England is headed by Bertrand Russell, if you had asked me, I would have said, who else? I would have been surprised if they'd chosen somebody else. This man sees conspiracies everywhere, and his view of American life is totally unrelated. He also goes in, by the way, for the inevitability of a class struggle, and that America does what it does because it's inevitable. It's an imperialist empire, and he said a lot of things that just seemed to me to make very little sense. So I'd be very surprised if he would. By the way, Bertrand Russell is of the opinion that Texas oilmen murdered President Kennedy. He's of that opinion, and he's very firm about it. He thinks it was a combination of Texas oilmen and the John Birch Society and the extreme right and the military, which combined to do in President Kennedy. He's of this view, and so are many others in Great Britain. But that should not persuade us, by the way, to... let's look at it still another way. If there were 500 of the top American newspaper men on the scene minutes after the shot was fired. The top journalists, the hard cynics, the hard-nosed reporters, the great columnists, everybody else, tracking down these. And by the way, I can tell you this as a matter of fact because my phone rang for days on end after the assassination from people all over the country trying to pick up little leads for me, because I had done a telecast on Oswald the day that the president was murdered. Before Oswald was killed, I did a 22-minute nationwide telecast because I had an interesting file on Oswald. He was just one of many people that I kept files on. I knew that he had been in fair play for Cuba. I knew that he had defected to the Soviet Union. And I was probably the only person in the whole country outside of governmental agencies that had a file on Lee Harvey Oswald. And so I went on television to talk about it. And from that point forward, newspaper men and women, even the late Dorothy Kilgallen called, wanting to know what else I could tell her. She was down there. They were combing everywhere, interviewing everybody, going over to Ruby's nightclub to find out things. Out of all those newspaper men, they never turned up anything of any consequence to show that anybody other than Oswald did it, except, of course, for Mark Lane, who was not a newspaper man anyway. He's an attorney. Not only that, but as J. Edgar Hoover points out in his testimony, that months and months of painstaking research from Secret Service, Army, Navy intelligence, the FBI, the CIA, everybody was in on it, working day and night, assigning 15 and 20 of the top people, the top criminologists, all fought over every fragment, little hairs, pieces of flesh, even a piece of the late president's brain was all looked into because of the angle of the shot and all the rest. And Hoover said in his testimony that despite all of this, the extreme left and the extreme right will still go on ranting and raving that on the one hand Oswald was framed, or on the other hand, on the extreme right, that Justice Warren, who headed the Warren Commission, is covering up for his communist pal Oswald. And he says, no matter what you do, no matter how much you put into this, and Hoover said, as much as it is humanly possible to determine the guilt, Oswald was it. And again, having faith in your system, now you could say, well, how does he know? Or how does somebody else know? I'd like to know how Bertrand Russell would know. I'd like to know how many hours Bertrand Russell investigated the case. He didn't even leave England. He didn't even get to Dallas. No, really, if you look at it that way, and my feeling would be that under our system, that if you have faith that Mr. Hoover is not a liar, and I don't think he is, if you have a feeling that maybe he alone would not be enough, but what about all the other people involved? Somewhere along the line, you have to place your faith and say that, well, an effort was made to determine the truth in this, and insofar as it is humanly possible to fix the blame for that dreadful act, it has been fixed on Oswald, not out of any sense of wanting to frame him, but I think that this is certainly the case. I for one would believe that. Yes.
I wonder if I could ask a question about your comment on parliamentary procedures. Mm-hmm. You made an interesting comparison between Fidel Castro and your favorite society leader from Belmont, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And you indicated that in the interview with your representative, Mr. Castro, agreed completely that the monolithic authoritarian pattern was the best way to run a country. And Mr. Welch apparently feels this is the best way to run a society. was the inference of your remark that Mr. Welch would also like to see our Constitution and our parliamentary procedures in the political scene set aside? I hope I didn't get that flavor from your comparison there. But
you should have, because that's exactly what I inferred, exactly what I meant. We can only go on what Mr. Welch is saying. And if Mr. Welch is laying down rules now for his deluded followers to follow, and if, of course, the rationale is that when, well, for example, they're trying to get 1 million members, let us say, which they have about 23,000 toward that goal. Their membership is below 25,000, despite their claim to the contrary. Now, if after working for several years on this kind of a structure, what guarantee would we have if the Byrd Society succeeded in being the dominant force in American life that they suddenly would go democratic? When Mr. Wells says democracy is a fraud to begin with, a perennial fraud, what makes you think that they would change in any way, shape, or form from an authoritarian monolithic structure to a democratic one, since he expresses his total contempt for democracy, calls it mobocracy? So the idea, for example, that, well, when the day comes when the Birches have their way, then everything's going to get right again, this is ridiculous. This is like trusting the communists to say that we'll have free elections after we consolidate the revolution. Some of my Castroite sympathizers and audiences will very often say to me, well, give him time to consolidate the revolution, then he'll have free elections. Well, I've been hearing that since the 1930s about the Soviet Union. They just celebrated their 48th anniversary, and they say it's a going concern, and that they're making more progress than us, and they haven't had a free election yet in the Soviet Union. They just celebrated their 48th anniversary of the October 1917 revolution, and they've yet to have a free election. Well, I can't see how Mr. Welch is suddenly, after years and years of schooling his adherents to the dangers of a democratic and a parliamentary system, he's suddenly going to overthrow all of this and institute it. So my inference should have been made perfectly clear. I meant that he has no interest in democracy, that he is an authoritarian himself. He has a totally authoritarian personality, and most of the members, most of the robots who follow him are pretty much the same way. In fact, I think that Mr. Welch is a good deal less vicious than his followers. The followers are the ones who go out and stick the little cards in the supermarkets. Mr. Welch doesn't. They're the ones who go out and put the little printed cards which say, thank you for supporting international communism by shopping with us, and then they sign the name of the A&P on the card. These conservatives who don't believe in tampering with private property, I might add, they slit open Polish hands and stick their little messages in it. Anybody who would do that, in my judgment, is just as guilty as the leader who tells them to do it. But I'm always told, of course, that, well, Mr. Welch may be a little extreme, but the rank and file are really neat. The rank and file are the ones who come out and break up my meetings, according to the Blue Book doctrines, and they break them up, believe me. I wouldn't want to recount the number of times we've had to call the police because of the demonstrations. I didn't want to, but the sponsors did. Yes? I'll happily send you one if you just write to me. Or you can write to the John Birch Society if you want and send them a couple of dollars. If you want a free one, write to me.
I don't want to break this meeting up, but it's been going on for 2 hours. And I noticed some people wandering out, and I'm sure there are some people who would like to because they're tired or they've got something else to do and they're just embarrassed. I know this man. I know that those of you who desire to stay here, he'll stay with you until you stop or until I drag him off.
What are you suggesting?
So I'm just I'm making a speech. It's my turn. I'm suggesting that if we take a 2-minute break and anybody that wants to can split, man, the rest of you are welcome to stay.
Years ago,
oh, yes.
You and Dean Manning. Okay, was there ever any representation of the picture of you and Manning? Was there a recall from the typical gentleman to send a copy of the
No, I never. Now, this is
not probably the answer that you were looking for. We can get into something else a little bit later, but I have a feeling that people that take themselves all that seriously, you know, it's just kind of too bad, really. And there's something humorous about everything, and there must be something humorous in the civil rights struggle that would cause Martin Luther King to smile once in a while. And there must be something funny about FBI agents that, you know, that would make J. Edgar loosen up a little bit. And this is, again, my feelings about them would be different than most people. But if you stop to really think about it, think of how terribly grim both of these men are, always, all the time. Now, again, if you know them personally, you may find that out that, like most of us, they probably have a sense of humor underneath it all. But I would find both of their messages, and both of their messages, from my point of view, are responsible. But I would find them much easier to take if they were spiced up with a little humor once in a while. I don't mean humor for humor's sake, but just occasionally see something funny in a situation. I deplore the attacks on King as a communist, because he is not. And I deplore the use of that so-called communist training school that he was alleged to have gone to receive training. There's a picture that some of you may have seen, some of you may not have seen, but it's a widespread thing called Martin Luther King in a communist training school. To begin with, the school that he was at, on one occasion for 35 minutes, was not a communist training school. Number two, showing him sitting behind Abner Berry of the Communist Worker is a dastardly technique, because Abner Berry could have been here tonight, sitting in the audience, and no one would know the difference. Martin Luther King did not know who he was, and Abner Berry was seated at the press table covering Martin Luther King's address. And no one can control. There may have been Birches here tonight, for all I know. That doesn't make any of you guilty of being in the audience with Birches. There's no way of knowing. And that type of smear against King is a difficult thing to fight, and it has proven to be effective for the other side. But King may be a lot of things, but he's not a communist. I think he has been an effective civil rights leader. My feeling, again, is that he's lacking in humor, and that, to me, is kind of unforgivable. Question? Yes? Students for a Democratic Society would be very comparable, I might add, to the Young Americans for Freedom on the other side. SDS, as it's known in short, is a coalition of, well, let me put it another way, they follow a policy of non-exclusion. In other words, if you are an anarchist, let us say, a bomb-throwing anarchist on campus here, which is quite a ludicrous thing to even suggest at Rocky Mountain, but let's say that you're a bomb-throwing anarchist, you would be eligible to vote at SDS meetings, because they follow a policy of non-exclusion. If you're a tribalist, as they would put it, a communist, an anarchist, a socialist, anything, a fascist, a Nazi, and you wanted to come in with them and get down the same side of the street with them on a specific issue, whether it's opposing our policies in Vietnam or whatever the case would be, you're welcome, because there's a non-exclusion policy, and they seem to think that they can control the hotheads in the movement. So they become then a coalition of liberals, radicals, pacifists, and all the rest. And in that sense, they can be put in a fellow traveling class, because they have no objections to communists holding office within their movement. On the other hand, however, they demand that Goldwater free himself of the John Birch Society of Artists. They say, Mr. Goldwater will never be accepted in the family of responsible people until he gets rid of the John Birch Society. But when somebody says to them, get rid of the communist in your movement, or get away from this policy of non-exclusion, then they say, well, don't red bait me. Well, you see, you can't really red bait communists, and you can't Klux bait Kluxes, and you can't Birch bait Birches, and you can't Nazi bait Nazis. To call a communist is to be accurate. To call President Eisenhower a communist is to indulge in red baiting, which is very bad. And SDS has the same old weak argument all the time. They've been captured in a good many areas by the communists, because by their own admission, SDS says the communists work harder than the rest of us. They come first and go home last. And so they capture the key posts. Well, that's all the criticism has really been about of them. This is what extremists do. Extremists are not interested in furthering the ends of a group for the purpose of, let's say, serving the cause. They are usually interested in manipulating the group for their own power plays and such. A communist will join an organization if there's any chance of maneuvering it in the direction of his goals.
but he will not stay. I mean, they don't join garden clubs. There's no percentage there. You know, they don't join Mahjong groups. You know, they go out and they join that which can be brought around to their point of view. It's a perfectly logical development when you understand the nature of communism and the way they operate, and the same would be true of the extreme right. So SDS fits in that dangerous area. Now, for those of you, this is not for the older people here, but for the students, let me tell you something about the dangers of working with communists in student groups. I don't care how broad-minded you are about how much you can control. Take it from somebody who has seen what has happened to a good many liberal organizations. Let me cite just one case for you. Before the Hitler-Stalin Pact, there was a group brought into being in this country called the American League Against War and Fascism. They wanted the United States to get into the war as early as possible because Hitler's Germany was threatening the Eastern Front. This was before 1939. And so the communists, in secret, founded the American League Against War and Fascism. And they prodded the United States into ending Hitler and ending war, dropping bombs on Germany and all the rest, and getting in against the war, getting in the war against fascism. That's what it was called. And they hoodwinked a lot of actors and show people and authors and all the rest, and Bertrand Russell and Albert Schweitzer and so on. I mean, the usual list of the perennial suckers you found on this list as well. Edward G. Robinson was one who used to sign everything. Well, now, a lot of liberals said to these people, don't join these groups. They said, all right, we're against Mussolini and Hitler and Imperial Japan. It's a good thing to be against them. The Nazism and fascism threatened the whole world during the 1930s, and America was slow to recognize, because of the isolationist fever and everything in the United States, we were slow to recognize this particular danger. But on the other hand, when Hitler and Stalin signed a pact in the summer of 1939, the American League Against War and Fascism became the American peace mobilization. Bring the boys back home. We can do business with Hitler. The communists who were running it from the inside and behind the scenes changed the name. It was no longer Get Us in the War. Now it was the American peace mobilization. It changed overnight. Just as the communists once had a particular line on the race question, the communist line once paralleled the black Muslim line, a separate colony for Negroes in the South, a black belt in the South where only Negroes would stay and all whites would be excluded, and they would have their own form of government. This was the policy of self-determination for the Negroes, which was the communist line up until about 1932. Well, then it changed, but it could go back. Who knows what the communists will decide is in keeping with the science of Marxism. See, that was their interpretation of what Marx meant for American Negroes, you know, the scientific approach. That should make the whole chart that Marxism is science ridiculous to begin with. But what if it changed tomorrow? Then a lot of the groups now, like SDS, that are very hot on the discrimination issue, and they should be, if the communists and SDS pull out or decide to change the policies and if they're in positions of control, SDS would be hanging over the cliff. You cannot really successfully work with totalitarians if your interest is in the democratic process and improving one area or other of our national life. See, that's the difference. The same as SDS could never get through now a policy condemning Ho Chi Minh and the terror of the Viet Cong, because the communists and SDS have it all their own way, and thus we are the villain, and only we will be condemned because they're running the show in so many of the individual chapters. And so it goes. And it's a pity, because you think that the students would go back and say that the lessons of the 30s should be clear. They shouldn't make that mistake. Now, the liberals of the 30s who made the mistake is one thing. It was a new experience. After all, the Russian Revolution was only 16 years old or 13 years old at the start of the 1930s. But 48 years later, people still would be fooled by this sort of thing. It might have been inexcusable. But the hardest thing in the world to do is to tell a hot-headed young college student that he's wrong about this. You see, then you become, you know, Uncle Tom and all sorts of things. What can you do? Who else has a question? Yes, ma'am.
Could you comment on John Lindsay's victory in New York and the possible influence this may have on the Republican Party?
Well, yes, I would think that Republicans now, I think of taking the Republican Party spectrum from Goldwater to, let us say, Rockefeller, and I'm talking now about the realists within the real professionals, the Ray Blisses, the Dirksons, and all the rest, I am convinced, knowing enough of them as well as I do, that they regard a Lindsay victory as a very good omen. And even if some of them would not, let us say, like Lindsay's brand of independence or liberalism, that because of the uncanny victory there, that was a terribly uphill thing that he did. He was not out in front right from the start. He had a man who was siphoning off votes for quite a while, although ultimately Buckley also siphoned votes away from Abraham Bean. But Lindsay's victory was a phenomenal thing. Very few Republicans in that area wanted any part of that race. That's a Democratic city. And for him, the triumph has given new hope to what might be called the moderates of both liberal and conservative persuasion in the party. And I think that he certainly is going to be the man to reckon with within the party for a long time to come. Unless, of course, catastrophe set in and then he does a terrible job, and then if he goes down to defeat between now, say, 72 or 76, I don't see how Lindsay can miss being a presidential candidate on the Republican ticket. And it's largely, I think, because at the moment the Republican Party, despite a number of good men, tend to have a number of good colorless men. George Romney is a vote-getter, and he's an effective administrator, but he's as dry as the Christian Science Monitor as far as national appeal goes. And now, seriously, George Romney is not about he doesn't have what Sinatra has. He lacks voltage, let's put it that way. And I doubt very much whether he's going to go out and find it somewhere. I would think Mark Hatfield would be a real dark horse in the Republican Party as well. I'm talking now in terms of what is needed today to win. Now, you might deplore the fact that we need winning personalities, but I'm not so sure that this is all deplorable. If somebody has a lot of brains and a lot of initiative and a lot of ambition, a lot of aggression and a lot of know-how, and he happens to be very good-looking in the bargain, I think that's pretty unbeatable. Let's face it, the mystique of John F. Kennedy had something to do with his good looks, and I think it's ridiculous to assume that it didn't. He also had a lot of other things going for him. He had vision, and he had a sense of excellence, and he had an impressive record and a good many other things. And I think Lindsay is cast in that same mold. I can see nothing but the brightest prospect for both the party and Mr. Lindsay as long as he remains a firm policymaker in the high annals of the party, in the high ranks of the party, and I'm quite sure he will. This is speculation, of course. All of this could change if he fails to do very much with a very tough situation. Also now, if he becomes a good mayor, he is tackling one of the most difficult municipal governments in the world to run. He's tackling it in the face of all kinds of Democratic opposition. The Democrats are not out to make him look good. You must remember, Robert Kennedy also lives in that place, and this business of a Kennedy-Lindsay confrontation could happen. And that would be something, too. He is an heir to the legacy of JFK, Robert Kennedy, and now Lindsay having to buck that. So there are a lot of imponderables here that must be taken into consideration. But if Lindsay should surmount the insurmountable, namely, make some sense out of that chaotic situation in New York, the congestion, the traffic, the overcrowding, the blight, the smog, if he turns out to be just even a mediocre mayor, and that it doesn't slip back further but moves forward, or if he does a sensational and spectacular job, I feel there'd be no stopping him. This would be my own assessment of the Lindsay victory. And I think it was phenomenal, and I personally am delighted that he won. If I had been in New York, I would have certainly supported him. I agree with Mr. Buckley that Abe Bean was a routine political catastrophe. That's the only way of looking at it. And here's another case. Now, here's another situation where Abe Bean was absolutely without humor, and absolutely without color, and absolutely without articulation. He was kind of an administrative type, but nothing else. Now, you might say that why must we have a glamour boy like Lindsay? Well, I should think that anybody would rather listen to Lindsay than to Bean. Bean failed to excite anybody, and including President Johnson. It took a long time to come around before he even endorsed. That was kind of backhanded.
Okay.
Yes?
Well, recently in Montana, the Republicans alleged that the job person saying was half Republican and half Democratic, as far as his membership was concerned.
membership as divided between Republicans and Democrats in the John Birch Society back east?
National, well, back east.
Or national, or both.
Well, I will tell you that in my hometown of Boston, I have probably an index card on, if not 90% of the Birches, certainly 85%. And there are ways of course, I can determine Birches back home very easily. They come to all my meetings and heckle me. But aside from that, there are other ways of determining it. So I'll tell you, quite frankly, how I determine. And are you from Montana?
Yes.
I'll tell you one way how I determine membership, and because it's very simple. Each month, the John Birch Society, in its internal document, the members' bulletin, they have an agenda for the month. The leading article is usually impeach Earl Warren. The second one is get us out of the UN. The third one is support the Liberty Amendment. The fourth is support your local police stickers, or whatever the case may be. But usually somewhere in the list of things to do to keep you busy and to give you a sense of doing something, you usually write a letter to somebody or several somebodies, and very often the somebody is an American corporation of considerable stature. Firestone, United States Rubber Company, Xerox Corporation, whatever the case may be, and it is usually to protest the product that company manufactures because somebody in the company at the corporate executive level has said something that Mr. Wells doesn't like. That's usually what it boils down to. George Villa, for example, of the United States Rubber Company, said some nice things about the UN. Now, that's the 26th largest corporation in the world. Mr. Welch rebelled and told all the members to write Mr. Villa a letter and tell him that what's he doing following the Communist Party line by supporting the United Nations, you know, that sort of thing. Well, each month I get the bulletin fresh from the printers, so to speak, and I write to the company that is about to be hit, and I tell them, don't panic. You're about to be hit by nasty letters, and note, if you will, the sameness about them. These letters allegedly are written by individuals, but they all read exactly alike. And the tip-off, of course, is that Mr. Welch puts in, you're supposed to write to, let's say, Mr. Robert B. Patterson, Office of the Chairman of the Board, American Airlines, 660 Rockefeller Plaza, New York City, New York, 02203. Every letter has exactly that, you know, as the star. Now, you know, how does somebody living in Frying Pan Creek, Oregon, know that the zip code in Radio City is 02203 or something? And that's a sure sign. Well, at any rate, I tell them not to panic, and to make a long story short, which I'm incapable of doing, but what usually happens is that corporation will ultimately give me that mail because they don't know what to do with it. They're grateful for my having told them about it. They don't panic because they can see, after being pointed out, I usually send them a copy of the bulletin, that this is it. Now, I will tell you this, that's really the way that I determine who the Birches are, because after six or seven corporations give you the mail, and the same names from Montana show up in all the mail, written to the same six companies that happen to be in the Birch bulletin, you can be pretty sure that they're dyed-in-the-wool Birches from out here. And coming back to the statistics now, I checked the party registrations back east. Most of them are Democrats. Contrary to popular belief, most of the Birches in Massachusetts are members of the Democratic Party. It's 7-3 ratio at the present time. I would not know about here because it would be a difficult thing for me at this distance to take the list of people in Montana, which is very small, by the way. The mail from Montana that goes into corporations like Xerox is negligible. I don't really think there are very many Birches in Montana. I would think that you probably wouldn't have more than 90 to 100 members in the entire state of Montana that pay their dues regularly in the John Birch Society. Now, I'm sure that the Birch Society members are told another story from headquarters, because Mr. Welch is very anxious to have everyone think that they're growing by leaps and bounds, like they'll say they've doubled their membership in Vermont. But I only had 3 members, so that's it sounds very impressive until you really take a look at where they're going. My guess would be that nationally they have 25,000, and the bulk of them are in Texas and California. Now, do you have another question on top of that? Yeah.
No, and then I assume that nationwide, at least there's a lot of Texans, a large amount of them are Southern Democrats.
Yes, I think you're quite right.
I would account for it, in fact, that 7-3 in Boston are Democrats.
How do I count for what?
How is that you say 7-3 instead of 7-3 Republicans or right. 7 Democratic members in Massachusetts.
Well, Massachusetts has become in recent decades a Democratic state. But aside from that, I think that the reason there's confusion on this issue is that the Goldwater thing in the last election, you see, he did not make a clear-cut stand. In fact, just the opposite. He gave out his famous extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice. And then the Burchites had him thoroughly convinced that they represented a solid voting bloc that he could not live without. And he bought it. He should not have bought it because he wouldn't have won under any circumstances, in my judgment, but he would have done far better had he made his position on the John Birch Society clear. To me, the John Birch Society is the kiss of death politically. The John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan and other groups are not the wave of the future in the United States any more than the communists are. And anybody who thinks that they're going to get into the White House by courting 23,000 Birches, I think is sadly mistaken. But I expect politicians to not to always know these things, and it's very difficult to tell a man who is back is against the wall in a national campaign that he should be very firm on a specific issue. I have known Ted Kennedy, who hardly needs any support in Massachusetts. He's unbeatable. I've known him to go to the tiniest little civic clubs on the basis that he thought there were a lot of votes in, and then when he got there, there were only 10 people out to hear him. Politicians are easily deceived by letterheads and what seems to be a going concern. It's one of the hazards, I suppose, of being in public life. You go where you think there are votes. Some of the League ladies here will be very distressed, but the League of Women Voters is another group that they don't try to fool anybody, but the League of Women Voters must seem massive to some politicians back east, and the League of Women Voters just isn't very massive nationally. It's a very solid, responsible, respectable group, but it can't deliver the vote for anybody. I could be wrong, but I'd like to bet on that. Yes, ma'am, that's you can tell me I'm wrong.
What's the basis for the right-wing claim that Walter Luther was educated in Russia? That was mentioned in that book, and I'm there to call it treason. And I know that he's probably been over there, but what do you know what his education in Russia
He was not educated in Russia at all. He visited. I'm glad you brought this up. This one has not come up in a long time. Now, if we go back to the McClellan labor management rackets hearings, which went on for the longest time, in fact, they are still continuing at a lesser pace now. At the time that Senator McClellan, a Democrat from Arkansas, and a foe of Walter Ruther's, not a friend, but a foe of Walter Ruther's, in turn, Walter Ruther's union, the United Auto Workers, view Senator McClellan as a reactionary and a labor beta, and they would like to defeat him if they could, except I don't think the auto workers have very much strength in the state of Arkansas. Now, they investigated the United Auto Workers because there were some involvements here that needed to be looked into on both the labor and management side. This was actually the COLA strike in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, which involved the United Auto Workers. And during the course of that, several witnesses produced the same document, and the McClellan Committee looked into it. There were 12 different original letters that Ruther is alleged to have written from the Soviet Union about how he was being educated, and Senator McClellan himself, again, not a friend of Walter Ruther, said, if this is supposed to be evidence about an education that he allegedly received, and these are supposed to be original letters, they're all different. And they dismissed all of the witnesses that produced this alleged document showing that Walter Ruther wrote to somebody called Mel and Glad and said, yours for Soviet America, something like that. This was dismissed as a forgery, and by Senator McClellan himself, he said he could not accept it as documentary evidence. He suspected that they were made up and typed up by somebody and made to appear that Ruther had sent them. Now, just as I have seen, for example, in a good many places that I have been, my own birth certificate, which shows that I was born both Jewish and Catholic, depending on which certificate you're looking at. Really, you know, I run into these documents about myself. The guy says, isn't this your birth certificate? And it looks just like it. But somewhere along the line where it says, you know, religion, they've managed to either cut something out and put something in, but I wind up Jewish. You see, my name is Gordon Goldberg. Well, it really isn't. And I'm not going to fight this thing because it's ridiculous, but, you know, it could look very good and could find its way into a lot of different places. Now, none dare call it treason, I might add, is filled with this kind of misinformation, that President Roosevelt is alleged to have said that some of his best friends are communists. And then you look up the footnote or the reference, and it turns out that this is what some congressman remembers overhearing somebody telling, you know, back in the 1930s. Well, you know, this is hardly primary evidence. In fact, I am busy now in doing something on that book, on that one book. One group in Cleveland did check out the footnotes. You know, they said, let's take 25 footnotes at random and check them. 13 of them were so upside down that this group concluded that the rest of them must be that way. I have a man doing some research for me now who's checking every footnote. And when I'm finished, I am going to do an article on Nunn, Dear College Reason, checking every footnote, not just one. I know the footnote on Arthur Schlesinger is completely wrong, where he quotes Schlesinger as favoring socialism. Schlesinger says in his book, The Vital Sentence, socialism for certain backward countries has seemed to work reasonably well, but socialism for the United States would be disastrous. Stormy uses the front end of that quotation and leaves the back end of it off, which completely mutilates what Arthur Schlesinger had in mind. Schlesinger's whole book, The Vital Center, was a denial of the collectivist idea, saying that in America, dynamic capitalism has served us beautifully by providing us with material needs and maximum political freedoms. The whole book is a reaffirmation of the democratic heritage, and Stoneman makes it appear as though it's a book pleading the cause of socialism. And you must conclude when you come across something like that that the author's intent is deliberate. I don't let John Stoner off the hook as easy as I let Robert Welch. Robert Welch can't help himself. He's politically ignorant. But John Stoner must know what he's doing. He must know that when he leaves off a sentence, he drops it in the middle, that he is mutilating what a man had in mind. And that, to me, is unpardonable. I consider Stoner's book one of the most vicious things that I've ever read, because it is a tissue of half-truths and outright lies. Yes, sir?
Do you have any idea who is sending out that book now, or if any group that is sending it out?
Yes, the one group nationally is now mailing it out, Young Americans for Freedom. And I meant, by the way, that I got off on the subject of Yak before, I meant to say that Young Americans for Freedom corresponds on the extreme right the way that SDS does on the left. Yak can't free itself of all of these extremists on the right, although in and of themselves, Yak is a parliamentary-based group. And is not an extreme right-wing organization in and of itself, as SDS is not basically a communist movement on the left, but it has that same kind of flavor. Well, YAC is now sending that out nationally, and the whole thing underway is to have essay contests out in high schools. And they borrowed the name of Herbert Filbert. He's loaned his name, actually, and they're using his name as a rather famous name to promote the book, and it's getting an enormous distribution. It originally, by the way, was published by a non-existent publishing house. Here's another thing that Americans are having great trouble with today. They'll say, well, the book wouldn't have been published if it wasn't true. That book was never published. John Stoner had that book printed, and anybody in this room could write a book tomorrow on any subject, take it down to a printer and say, look, I want you to slap this between covers, put my picture on the back, have a dedication to my wife Maria or something, or to my husband Joe, and it would look like, you know, you're the hottest thing in Billings. You just published a book. You would pay, any printer would accept money to have a book printed. John Stoner made up the name of the publishing house, Liberty Bell Press, which doesn't even exist, and didn't exist until the district attorney in the city of Florissant, Missouri, and St. Louis, St. Louis and Florissant are sort of adjoining towns there, decided that this violated a law. There's a local ordinance there that you cannot print things under false labels. And Stoner then went out and incorporated the Liberty Bell Press at his home. And his wife and he are the incorporators. He had the book printed. Now, I don't say that a man can't print a book and still write a good book. That's not the point. But let's distinguish between that which is published and royalties are paid on it and that which is simply printed. A man can go out and cut a recording today if he wants to. Judging from the spate of recordings by non-entities in the music field, I guess that's what they're doing. But anybody in this room could go out and pay to have a recording made of your voice. But it's something else to get RCA Victor to put its label on your recording. There's a difference. And this is a problem that people are having. They're saying, well, what about the strange death of Marilyn Monroe, which purports, which shows that Robert Kennedy murdered her? I'm not joking. This is... written by a man named Frank Capel, who was recently convicted in the Senator Kiko case on the West Coast. Well, that book is published by the Herald of Freedom. Well, the Herald of Freedom is Frank Capel. He had the thing printed. It's quite a difference. Question? Yes, ma'am. Yes, I know the guy you're talking about, and I would say that 85% of them have long histories of being involved in this going way, way back. That's so predictable. It would almost be, for example, like, Stoner's book getting favorable reviews. Stoner will put out flyleaves on where his book has been favorably reviewed, and you can be sure it'll be American Opinion, a whole host of right-wing publications. Now, some of them, of course, some of those professors are newer on the scene, and some of them would be pacifists. There are a number of professors, college professors, who are pacifists. If you notice, though, that most of them were from relatively obscure places, and many of them were in different departments like biochemistry or romance languages. And I often wonder how it is that a 27-year-old professor of biochemistry is an expert on Vietnam. And I don't ask this question facetiously, but even though I keep abreast of the Vietnam crisis going way back in the history of that crisis, I have turned down offers to lecture on Vietnam. I won't do it on either side. I wouldn't give a talk defending government policies, although I personally believe that we must be there, simply because this is not my bailiwick. That's a very complicated deal. And yet it doesn't seem to bother a college professor who scarcely knows where Hanoi is to... I'm quite serious. Not all college professors know where Hanoi is. Let's be realistic about it. It doesn't bother them at all to slap their names on these things to sign. But I guess there is a strong feeling in the academic community in some places that we are wrong, and so they will lend their names. I saw a number of college professors who supported... Clifton DeBerry, the Socialist Workers' Party. They said that Lindsay was a fraud, that Lindsay was simply a playboy, and they couldn't support him. Beam was an nonentity and part of a corrupt Democratic machine, and they couldn't support him. Buckley was an extreme right winger, and they couldn't support him. And so they, as a protest vote, they voted for Clifton DeBerry, a communist on the Socialist Workers' ticket. And there must have been 27 professors who signed that ad in the New York Times from the New York area, City College. And it was the same thing, you know, professor of zoology. I saw very few in the Department of History or in the Department of Political Science. But you must remember that the academic community is large. For example, in the old days at Harvard, during the McCarthy period, which is a very unpleasant period on national life, there were three college professors who turned out to be members of the Communist Party on the faculty at Harvard. But at that time, Harvard had almost 2,000 people at the faculty level, so 3 out of 2,000 is a minute kind of thing, and it must be, again, taken in balance. And my guess would be that the overwhelming bulk of college faculty members in the United States, while they might not be as vocal as the extremist elements among the faculty members, probably would overwhelmingly be found in a kind of a democratic broad mainstream. I'm quite convinced of this. The record sort of McDaniel. Yes.
Sort of, I might say, in answer to how this thing happens sometimes, is that frequently we will get mail.
I didn't answer that part of your question.
Both as a faculty member and as a clergyman from two sides. I often get mail from outfits with a card that says, yes or no, you stop beating your wife, or we all get out of Vietnam.
How do you handle that one?
And, yes or no. Had you invited to sign this card and send it back with or without a contribution to help pay for this full page ad in the New York Times? I suppose what happened this time is you'd be enough people to put a half page
ad. I'm sorry I didn't answer that second part of your question. On the payments,
very often a fairly substantial sum would come from the group that would be closest to it, like if it's the ad hoc university committee to end the war in Vietnam, and I don't remember specifically now whether this was just independent signers or whether this had an ad hoc name to it, but very often the parent group would have some budget left over from a previous collection or a rally or something else, or they are working with a number of groups that would provide money. If you subscribe, for example, to the National Guardian, let's assume for the sake of argument you get that through the mail, once you send in $7 for a year's subscription, in the next 12 months you will get appeals from some of the same groups you're talking about with the same stencil plate. I mean, your name would be put on a stencil and the date of the expiration of the thing would be, you know, 365 or something. And notice, after you subscribe to that in the next 12 months you'll get a curious number of us because the Guardian tied in this orbit, or somebody else over here became available. They exchange mailing lists, they exchange confidences all the time, and you're apt to be hit by an application. And we're not asked to sign, just as a swipe in billing. Will you help out to defray the 3,000 Z, or the 2,500, or the 750? Very, very broad mailings. I say you must get how many in the course of a month? From all different kinds.
Not enough, but I'll probably get 15 or 20 a year.
No, and I would say that maybe somebody living in a hovercraft remember, because it's closer to a lot of groups that are involved, probably
many. $7 and sign them all.
Well, that's how a few more. I'll wrap this up, yes.
By saying that the organizations that share these mailing plates are sympathetic, you know, one with the other, would this mean that one group might be, or that groups that do this would be, say, a group of fellow travelers?
Oh, yes. I can give you a specific example. A friend of mine subscribed to the National Guardian. I needed a new name on the list because I wanted to get a couple of extra copies for some librarians and a council of church framework back east. And he got on. A couple of weeks later, he got... After the first time, he got the wrapper with a stencil on it. And the first time, he just got a typewritten response. And then the second time, the stencil. About 3 weeks later, he received... an appeal from the Monroe Defense Committee down in Monroe, North Carolina, that involved some real controversy over the Klan and the NAACP. The Monroe Defense Committee has been captured by the communists in that particular area. Now, if you read The Guardian every week, you would see that they were raising funds in the back pages for the Monroe Defense Committee. So it was no surprise that this person got a similar open response from Monroe, North Carolina. The assumption being that after having subscribed to it and sent us $7 in for the newspaper, that takes care of 12 months, 52 issues, then they go, well, here's a guy who may have $10 on the side for somebody else. And so that name was shipped or given or called in to a like-minded group, fellow traveler, whatever you wish. And you wouldn't, for example, you would not subscribe to, let us say, American Opinion, and then you get the work of the next week on the same stencil plate. It would have to be within the same general family of organizations, but it's inevitable. It happens almost every time. And sometimes 8 and 10 and 12 different groups.
How would you rank the various civil rights groups along the spectrum? Groups like, say, CORE and NAACP, various other ones?
I would rank CORE and the NAACP and the Urban League, although the Urban League is much less a civil rights group than the it's more of an employment placement kind of group. NAACP and CORE both to me would be mainstream, democratically oriented, let's do things in the spirit of fair play, test the law, and if we lose, you know, suffer the consequences. Although I would certainly consider them mainstream, legitimate, honestly based civil rights movements that are genuinely interested in first-class citizenship without any side access to grind. Once you start getting over into SNCC and some of the others, you're getting into the SDS type of thing. SNCC also follows a policy of non-exclusion. They say, don't red bait me. We don't have any loyalty oaths in our group. If a guy's a communist and he's working with us on this issue, we don't particularly care. We wouldn't know a communist if we saw them. They don't carry flags or something like that. They're very, very militant about this, and they think that anybody who raises this question is doing it because they're trying to destroy the civil rights movement.
Sosnick has been penetrated by some communists. NAACP is very sophisticated about this. CORE is quite sophisticated about this. The Urban League is terribly sophisticated about this, and so on.
Well, you would say then that these first three groups would protect their willingness from the Guardian, so forth.
My guess would be that in 99 out of 100 cases they would. Now, there may be instances where, let's say, a CORE chapter leader in let's say, Cleveland, would hear about the plight of the Monroe Defense Committee and not know anything about the Monroe Defense Committee because it's a fairly new group in the last couple of years. Thus, they might turn over, let us say, the mailing list of the CORE chapters to some militant who is interested in that. I mean, you get all levels of sophistication at the local level, but as a national policy, CORE would not turn its mailing list over to any of these groups, and neither would the NAACP. I say that with assurance. You have information to the contrary? Well, let's hear about it. I'd be interested.
Yeah. I wrote one for information to CORE, you know, about the organization.
Right. Now, CORE where? In New York?
The national office.
Well, that would be in New York.
You know, on their publicity thing. And the, you know, the mailing sticker, I happened to keep that, and within several weeks, I got the National Guardian and didn't think anything about it until, you know, it began coming, you know, rather regularly.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at the, you know, having to compare the, you know, address labels. They had the same initials, you know, same post symbols.
I can believe it. To me, that would be an exceptional case in CORE. I don't think that would be, I can't imagine how this happened, but I've been surprised occasionally. There was one time when this happened with Martin Luther King's mailing list. Somehow, friends of mine got things from the International Publishers, which is a Marxist house, completely separate and divorced from the Martin Luther King group, and the stencils were identical. There may be concealed extremists in these movements that you know nothing about who capture mailing lists. There's so much hanky-panky going on all the time, capturing mailing lists, it's hard to know, but I would think as a policy matter, if you went to Jim Farmer and said, now look, would you knowingly, willingly cooperate with the National Guardian? Surely would be an emphatic no. I have my differences with Jim Farmer, but I know him long enough and well enough to know that he would certainly regard the National Guardian in the same light that I'm sure the both of us would, so that if any hanky-panky went on there, it would have to come from office personnel. It's very difficult to for any group to be Simon Pure in these matters because of the kinds of people that work into your movements and do office work sometimes. I have to be very careful about the kind of people who write to me for this literature. That's why I want a written letter. I don't want to just take a kid's name. I want to find out what kind of letter they write. There's some people that I will not send literature to based on the tone of the letter. If I sense that the man is a Ku Kluxer or a communist, I'm not going to waste my time and his getting into this sort of thing. I want to write to people who are seriously interested in finding out what's going on in these areas. One more question?
These various front organizations can change their name so quickly and so rapidly. And is there any way to, check on these various groups to find out, all the technical things that are coming? How do you evaluate these various groups that you would get?
Well, I would say that, I would say first and foremost, they have to be read. And you have to go beyond the business, like the fellow in the back and I say, well, how do you account for the fact that Bertrand Russell, his name is there? That apparently maybe didn't convince him of something. And that alone would be enough to sell some people on them. They say, well, if it's good enough for Bertrand Russell, it's good enough for me, even though it might say, kill the Jews in the middle paragraph, or something like that. It's possible. A lot of people look for names, and if somebody whom they respect and admire is on the letterhead, that automatically makes a group good. I think what we must learn to do as citizens is read stuff like that, or else just if you're not interested, that's something else, then toss it away. But if you're going to make any move, if you're going to send any money, or if you're going to be knowledgeable about this sort of thing, the important thing to do is to read it. Now, if you have any kind of a framework, a frame of reference about politics in general, or economics or something else, chances are you'll be able to. In your case, I mean, we've only talked a few minutes, my guess would be that you could probably fathom almost any appeal like this. That is, if you're willing to take the time. Now, if you're stuck, I am always willing to help anybody out with that sort of thing, but by and large, there's no place anywhere in the country, there's no central clearinghouse where you can write and say, quickly, give me a rundown on this group. And I don't think there should be, quite frankly. I don't think we should have any central clearinghouse that is going to play God with all organizations, because it's too tempting to say, I won't think for myself, I'll write to Washington and somebody else will tell me whether this is good, bad, or different. I've had people ask me to compile lists for them. I've had business friends say, why don't you give us a list of all the good groups and all the bad groups? We'll give you $1,000, you know, as a retainer fee. Well, that's absurd, you know. Let them do their own thinking. They're grown men, and if they made it in the business world, they ought to be able to figure out what a publication has to say about something. It's 11 o'clock. I'm going to call it off with one more question, all right? Yes.
Could you comment on the thoughts about Malcolm X and the
Would I comment on that? Yeah. I'd be happy to. I happen to be probably one of the only persons in the country that debated Malcolm a number of times when he was alive. In fact, I debated Malcolm in New York City two nights before he was shot and killed. And it was the last public appearance other than that brief time when he walked out on the platform and was shot. I am of the opinion that Malcolm X and the Muslims were a creation of the American press. And I consider myself a part of the American press since I do a great deal of writing for the Boston papers and the New York papers and magazines and so on. Malcolm X came to the Muslim movement at a time when it probably had about 2,000 members, although the press was reporting it as 100,000 because Elijah Muhammad said we have, I don't know, he said 100, 200,000. Imagine a leader not knowing whether he has 100 or 200,000 dues-paying members. I mean, it's absurd. But anyway, that's what he was saying. Malcolm came to it when it had about 2,000, and because of his personality, his charm completely escaped me, but it apparently made a big hit with a lot of people. He built that movement from about 2,000 to 15,000 dues-paying members. And he became number one. And Elijah saw this, that Elijah would come to a meeting hall and the place would only be partially filled. Malcolm would pack them in everywhere because he was rabid and firm, and a lot of people thought extremely articulate. I thought he was one of the most ignorant men I've ever met. Malcolm X articulated nothing. He was the Casey Stengel of American politics. He talked a lot and said absolutely nothing, but he said it with a lot of force. You know, as though everything he said were right on target. I'll give you a good example. In a debate with him one time, I said, Malcolm, stop pulling my leg. How many members of the Muslims? You know I know how many members you have. Tell these, this is at MIT in Massachusetts. Tell the people how many members you have. Malcolm said, you know, he said, one thing about you, he said, you don't realize that the white race is in a state of decline. He said, the other day in the British Parliament, Arnold Toynbee, said, you know who Mr. Toynbee is, Mr. Hall? I said, sure, don't tell me about Mr. Peace. So well, the other day in the British Parliament, Arnold Toynbee said, the white race is in a state of decline. And Malcolm went on and on and on. Arnold Toynbee's never served in the British Parliament, you see? But it sounded terribly convincing, and the audience applauded. They thought he had scored a point. I think he said to him, you know, tell me about, you asked me about Arnold Toynbee. Now, you know, what seat does he hold? Which party is in the British Parliament? So Malcolm said, you know which party he's in as well as I do. Don't ask me that. Well, the funny part is, you know, Toynbee's not in either party because he's not in the parliament in the first place. Now, that's the kind of ignorance that Malcolm pulled on audiences all over the country. Now, after his break with the Muslims, Elijah wanted to get rid of him because Malcolm was getting too big. There wasn't room for the two of them. Now, if you're subservient like Cassius Clay and you want to bow down before Elijah, then you're okay in the movement, but Malcolm was getting too big for his britches. And so the old man looked for a convenient excuse to drop him. And the excuse was that when the president was assassinated, Malcolm said, this is the case of the chickens coming home to roost, and he didn't feel any pain. And so Elijah said this was a despicable thing to say, and so he was suspended and ultimately dropped. Actually, Malcolm X said, Elijah Muhammad said far worse things about President Kennedy all the time that he was running the Muslim movement and all the time that the president was the president. At any rate, Malcolm then started to look around for something, and he developed this thing called the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which never had more than 250 or 300 members nationally. At best, a very small movement, much smaller than the Muslims. And short of having any kind of a base to operate, from September of last year, last fall, not this past September, but a year ago, September of 64, until February of 65, Malcolm began getting in bed with all the communists in the New York area. He was flirting with the Socialist Workers' Party, and he delivered 7 talks before the Socialist Workers' Party in which he said that Marxism appealed to him. Yet today, after the assassination of Malcolm, the men who wrote his biography, said that Malcolm was moving in the direction of the civil rights movements. He was moving into the mainstream of civil rights. Malcolm couldn't have been further away from the civil rights movement if he fell over a cliff out here. He was nowhere near the civil rights movement. His last stand was with the communists because he had no other place to go. And the time that I debated him in New York, which was on a, he was shot on a Sunday, I debated him on a Friday, he brought 4 people with him to the rally, to the debate, and I got him very angry in the meeting because I said, I see you brought the whole membership with you tonight, which really infuriated him. And he said to me, you're such a smart aleck. He said, you come to my meeting Sunday at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, I'll have 10,000 of my followers out there. And it's on the tape now. This thing was taped and televised. And I said, Malcolm, you'll be lucky if you have 400 people at the Audubon Ballroom, even though it'll hold several thousand. You'll have 350, 400 people, and most of them will be curiosity seekers, whites and Negroes alike, who want to see you because you are apparently an attractive personality, although why I'm going to know. And when Malcolm was shot down, he had 377 people in the audience, even though he boasted right in front of the cameras that he had 10,000 people out there. He was a pathological liar. He never knew what he was saying. He just spouted all the time. But for some reason, he caught on as a leader, so-called, as an intellectual. Malcolm was a hopelessly ignorant man. He's like Robert Welch. He just spouts and babbles and never said anything that ever made any sense. And whenever he wrote anything, he always had ghostwriters. He always had people. But on top of all of that, the worst and despicable thing about Malcolm is after he would say things to me like, he called me a Belgian white mercenary in the middle of the last debate, which is absurd. You know, I'm an American. I'm not a Belgian. But he was, I had him cornered on the business of some of the things that he had said in previous debates. Like he defended Muslims in outer space in the first time I debated him, because that was the party line, you see. The old man believes, the old man out in Chicago, a lot of them are very superstitious, and he believes that there are Muslims on flying saucers, and that there's a black man on the moon, and all this sort of thing. So Malcolm was forced to believe it. Now Malcolm never believed it. But in the debate with him at MIT, I said to him, come on, Malcolm, tell us about the flying saucers. And knowing perfectly well, he would have to, because it was the line, you see. So he went before him, he said, well, as a matter of fact, we have a lot of evidence to show that there are black men out on flying saucers. We have several of our people on the moon. Now, just as straightforward, you know, and the audience almost died listening to this sort of thing. I'm surprised you don't think it's funny. I think it's hilarious. But at any rate, he went on and on in this vein. And I've forgotten exactly what I was going to say now in relationship to the final debate, but he was thrown off balance by references to previous debates, and yet he would go on and on and on just making up anything. And this, for some reason, a man who gets up in public and speaks forcefully, he may not have the slightest idea of what he's talking about, like Robert Shelton in the Ku Klux Klan, who babbles endlessly. He says that we are Bible-believing Christians. We just won't let any Catholics in our movement, any Jews in our movement. In our movement. He opens his mouth on one hand and contradicts everything he said the next hand. And people say, he's a wonderful speaker, that man's intelligent, boy, he's really on the ball. Malcolm was the same way. To me, he parlayed nothing into something. The worst thing about him, now I know what I was going to say. Backstage, after the, the last debate, he put his arm around me and said, come on, let's go up to Harlem and get something to eat and drink. He said, I know a neat place up there. He said, it's a little jazz combo. He said, I like you. He said, you have a lot of guts, and he punched me in the ribs. He said, come on, let's go. Actually, he called me a Belgian white mercenary on television. He wants to go out and have a meal with me. So I said, if you go up there and have your own meal, I'm fussy with whom I eat. And I said, the difference between you and me, Malcolm, is I meant it when I called you an ignoramus. I think you are a vicious man. I think you're a demagogue and a hater. And I mean it. And apparently you don't mean any of these things you say about me. You don't mean anything. You're just an adventurer. And you're floundering around looking for some place to settle. And you hit upon this theme of the white devil and it's paying off for you. And that briefly is my analysis of Malcolm. And I did 3 pieces immediately upon his death along these same lines. I was asked by the Boston papers to give my impressions of it since I had seen it. So, you know, just before I was shot, and I said the same thing. That men who live by the sword die by the sword. Not the one who will miss it. And haven't missed it. Boy, a lot of people jumped all over me for that, you know. I mean, if a man is a scoundrel on Saturday, the mere fact that he gets shot on Sunday doesn't make him less than a scoundrel. And I'm not sentimental about death. I don't like to see anybody gunned down in the streets, and for that I was sorry. I don't like to see a man shot in cold blood. But if a man's a scoundrel on Saturday, and I say so, I don't change my mind on Sunday. He was a scoundrel, and he was a scoundrel right up to the last day. It's a pity that he had to go out that way, but it's not surprising quite of what he does. That's it. It's 10 after 11. I have to go. Thank you.
They say anything on the assumption that they know something. So, it looks like they're going to get a hand over it and put it out.
America.